Hello and welcome to the Comic Book Page Podcast. My name is John Mayo, and I'll be your host. The episode you're about to hear originally ran as Comic Timing episode number 52. In it, Ian Levenstein led a discussion with Brent Cassina, Bob Reichall, and myself about the wedding of Green Arrow and Black Canary. We discussed the JLA Wedding Special number 1, Green Arrow Black Canary Wedding Special number 1, and Green Arrow Black Canary number 1. I want to thank Ian for coordinating this episode and letting us release it on the Comic Book Page feed. This episode was originally released on the Comic Timing Podcast feed on December 13th, 2007. If you aren't already a listener of Comic Timing, go check it out at www.speakgeekspeak.com/comictiming. Ian is one of the best comic book roundtable discussion podcasts out there.
Welcome to episode 52 of Comic Timing, a comics podcast devoted to the average comic book fan from the average comic book fan. Join in this rotating panel of guests and myself, Ian Levinson, discuss whatever comes to mind, time after time, here on Comic Timing. Well, it's been a while, but we have ourselves a new 22 pages review. This time, a little bit more than 22 pages, more like 60-something, possibly even 70, as we do the entire Black Canary Wedding arc. JOA Wedding Special number 1, Green Arrow Black Canary Wedding Special, and Green Arrow Black Canary number 1. Bob Breitall, John Mayo, and Brett Cassina join me for it. Spoilers galore, and enjoy. Here now, Comic Timing. Hey there, folks. My name's Ian Levinstein, and welcome to episode 52 of Comic Timing. 52! Woo! Yeah, we're not talking 52 on this episode. We did that already. However, we do have one of the guys who did talk 52 with us back for this episode. Well, we have the combination, the Comic Book Page podcast combination, as it were, on this episode. And I'll introduce them here first, John Mayo and Bob Breitall. What's up, guys?
Oh, not too much. I'm looking forward to talking Countdown, since we're not doing 52. We're doing Countdown, right?
I don't want to have a negative episode. I'm sorry. I think.
Okay, so it's not Countdown.
No, it's not Countdown. We're talking something else that might have some negatives and positives thrown in there, but what are you going to do? We might do that eventually, though, and that's going to be good times. But how you doing, Bob?
Very good. Then the issues that we are talking about tonight, there are some negatives and positives.
Yes, indeed. We'll get into that, certainly. And, of course, the co-host, Brent Cassina. What's up, Brent?
What's up, guys?
Not much. All right, yeah, the issues in question, this is technically the 22 pages review, although this is about like 60 some odd pages once we're done.
It's more than that. All three of these are like double-sized?
I think so, actually. I wouldn't be surprised about that. But we've got the Justice League of America Wedding Special, number one. We've got the Green Arrow Black Canary Wedding Special, number one. And we've got the first issue of Green Arrow and Black Canary, number one, to review here. Because it's all sort of the same story combined, except for the JOA Wedding Special. We'll get into that. But before we get into the actual issues, I want to put a generic question out there for everybody. What was the first thing you thought when you heard that Green Arrow and Black Canary were finally going to get hitched? And I guess we'll start with you, Brent.
I don't know. It just seemed like they didn't really need to get hitched. Mm-hmm. And then I kind of figured that they'd probably do a little event around it, which they did. But I'm pretty pleased with the quality of it so far. I mean, I haven't read issue 2 yet of the regular series, but I'm pretty happy with these 3 issues, so it didn't turn out so bad for me.
Bob?
I thought it was about time. Myself.
Yeah, well, how many years now have they been dating? Since, what, the 60s?
Yeah. It just seems – I've always thought that they belong together, you know, since the 70s or whenever they started going out. Mm-hmm. I've thought it was a good pairing and just thought it was about time that they – got married, and they did a good job on it because they really, you know, threw a little trick in on that one issue, and then they kind of brought you back from the edge in the next one. I kind of figured that was going to happen, but they did it in a good way, I thought.
Right, yeah, and obviously spoilers heavy in this episode, just to warn people ahead of time here. John, your take?
Pretty much the same as Bob's. It's kind of a about time sort of situation, because the entire time I've been reading, it's like those two were on that path anyway, so... You know, the fact they finally decided, okay, let's get them married and go with that, mm-hmm. You know, has literally been decades in the making.
Yeah. And, well, they did have a shorter courtship than Lois and Clark, at least. So I guess maybe we can give DC that much, that they finally got hitched before, like, maybe 60 years had passed or something like that.
In the on the plus side, Black Canary didn't spend the entire time trying to out Oliver Queen as Green Arrow.
Right. Yeah, they have a bit of a better relationship than Lois and Clark had, and a bit less complicated. Although, with all the times that Ollie cheated on Black Canary over the years, complicated might not even be the right word to say. But, yeah, we're here. Let's do this. Let's start off with the JLA Wedding Special number one. There was also a Black Canary Wedding Planner, but we're going to skip that one, as that one kind of felt like it was a bit filler to me. I didn't really add that much to the actual storyline, so we'll start with the JLA Wedding Special number one. Now, my initial reaction to this is it should have been called Justice League of America issue 12.5, because this was not a wedding special, really. I mean, sure, the wedding was in there, but it was much more a Justice League issue than a special for the wedding that was taking place. And I'd like to get your guys' take on that to see whether or not you agree with that, because there were some major plot points that were brought forward in this that, for one thing, when I read Justice League of America number 13, I didn't realize I had to have read Justice League of America Wedding Special first to know what the hell was going on. John, you agree with that?
Yeah, well, I mean, you look at the cover to it, and you're thinking it's going to be like a bachelorette party or something,
right,
with Superman hopping up the cake and stuff, and that so doesn't represent what's going on in this issue.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, Bob and I talked about this on our podcast, and it's kind of – and we had the exact same reaction. They gave it the wrong title. This really shouldn't have been, you know, Justice League of America Annual number one, I think.
Mm-hmm. Had they have gone that route, I would have been a lot happier.
Yeah. I mean, I think they mismarketed this book strictly by the title and the cover, and it set very different expectations than what I think they should have given the contents of the issue.
Mm-hmm. Bob, I'm sure your comments sort of echo John there.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, like John mentioned, we had covered this one on an episode of our show, and that was exactly, you know, what you said there. It led right into that Justice League 13. It was really Dwayne McDuffie's intro to the Justice League, and if they had marketed it more as a Justice League first part of that Injustice Gang story as opposed to something about the wedding, because that Injustice Gang stuff was much more central to the issue than anything about the wedding.
Right. Yeah. No, the wedding definitely takes a back seat in this. That's why, hence, the wedding special at the beginning really doesn't work in the actual issue. Brent, your take?
Yeah, I agree with them. I think there's a lot less wedding in here than the cover implies. I mean, it basically ends at Ollie's bachelor party, and then we get right down to the adventure and into JLA 13.
Yeah. And it also leaves me asking a question as, well, we see a bit of a possible bachelor party going on in the actual Green Arrow Black Canary wedding special that seems to happen a bit differently than this, which is why I was sort of confused about that, even that, because those events don't seem to match up entirely.
I think there's just some general confusion on the timeline and exactly what happened when and where.
Mm-hmm.
Between this, the Green Arrow Black Canary stuff, the actual Justice League series itself, and even Countdown.
Yeah.
This is something that if, particularly in the middle of such a big, you know, overall arc that they're doing for the whole universe with Countdown, something like this kind of event, they really should have had a better timeline of events and kept it a little tighter coordinated.
Yeah.
Well, I just reread all three of these issues in the past hour and a half or whatever, just to get a little refresher. And the actual wedding special just has that scene from the JLA wedding special where they get rid of the strippers for the bachelor party. You don't really see the bachelor party in the actual wedding special. You see the bachelorette party,
mm-hmm,
which kind of runs the same as the one that's in JLA and Countdown.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not as contradictory as one might think.
Well, I think, though, if you start factoring in what happens in Justice League and you look at the timeline of the three issues we're talking about and kind of the implied timeline over there, it doesn't sync up perfectly. It's not, you know, oh, my
yeah,
God, it's horrible. What were they thinking? But there's just enough subtle inconsistencies to get a little frustrating, but yeah, not too bad.
Well, especially with, like, the Justice League going off and, like, battling Injustice Gang and all that, or Injustice League or whatever you want to call them at this point, and then the wedding happening and they're all there, it just leads me to question exactly when the wedding happened, because it seems like they want to make it seem like it's happening immediately afterwards, like a day or two afterwards, but this whole situation with the Injustice League feels like it takes a lot longer than that to actually work itself out. So yeah, it's a bit difficult to actually get a timeline. Let me give you the cast of writers and artists and such on the Justice League of America wedding special. The writer, of course, is Dwayne McDuffie, who takes over Justice League with this issue. Hence, again, why I felt like it could have been an annual. Mike McCone is the penciler. We have Andy Lanning on inks. Peter, I believe that's Pantazis, on colorist. And Rob Lay is the letterer. Ed Bennis with Alex Sinclair did the cover. And Adam Schlagman was the associate editor, with Eddie Braganza as the editor. The art in this really made me hope that we were going to see more Mike McCone on Justice League, because this was stunning.
Yeah, this was some great stuff. I really liked how, I don't know if this was McCone or the script, but, you know, this opening three pages in this wedding special echo JLA number one, where you just see, like, the chest where the emblem would be of the main, you know, the Trinity, except this time it's the villains. Mm-hmm. And really, you know, the only one that has a real emblem is Lex. And then you turn the page, and then you got that two-page spread where they're all arguing and throwing down pictures on a table. It was a great echo of what Metzler did in the JLA issue.
Yeah,
I thought that was really cool, just the way it was laid out and stuff.
I hadn't caught that, but you're entirely right, yeah.
Yeah, and the coloring was very lush in this as well. In fact, for all three of the issues on this, I feel probably the most consistent thing throughout, even though that they were three different colorists, the coloring was very consistent throughout. Like, it all sort of gelled together. It all flowed very, very well. So, I mean, I'm a huge Mike McCone fan. That's why I love this issue so much. But again, it continues on in the other two. Bob, were you a fan of the art?
I actually like this art a little better than the main artist on the Justice League 13. I'm drawing a blank on who that is.
Mm-hmm.
Benitez?
Benitez.
Yeah, Benitez, yeah. And he's a little Ed McGuinness-y.
Right.
For me. I like this style a little better. It's not bad on the regular JLA, but I do prefer the McCone Lanning art in this issue. It's kind of a cleaner, more classic DC hero style.
Mm-hmm. Well, correct me if I'm wrong, but wasn't this the first issue McCone has done, a complete issue of a DC comic in quite some time now? I know he did some art on 52, but that was just select pages. So to have him do a complete issue of DC after his time spent in Marvel, this was like his return issue in a way.
That could very well be.
Yeah, I don't know if you're right or wrong on that. I don't keep that close a track on the various artists.
Okay.
Yeah. I think you're right, Ian. But I want to know what he's going to do next. Isn't he back at DC or something?
I believe so. I believe he signed an exclusive contract with them. I'll have to look that up. He's not doing Marvel work anymore, that much I know. I mean, he's off of Fantastic Four now, has been for quite some time. And this is the first real, like I said, the first real first issue, complete issue we've seen him do in a while, period. And it's definitely for DC. So I wouldn't be surprised if he ends up on one of the big books sometime soon, maybe Batman even, but who knows.
Yeah, I hadn't really taken note of his art before. It's not a name that, you know, when I saw it, mm-hmm. Oh, you know, McCone, I'm going to have to keep an eye out for that. But now that you kind of mention it here, I will be keeping an eye out for this guy in future, because he did a really nice job on this issue.
Well, he launched the Teen Titans book with Jeff Johns, and then he did that for a while, and then he went over to Fantastic Four for quite a while, and then now he's doing this, right?
Didn't he also launch Exiles over at Marvel way back?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, with Winnick.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So he's done a bunch of stuff. I mean, that's where I first noticed him was Teen Titans, and then over to FF.
Yeah.
Yeah, Teen Titans was his first real, I guess, big profile thing. However, he did do one of the issues, not the full thing, I believe. I could be remembering this wrong, though, but in the Final Night crossover. Actually, yeah, you know what? Actually, I think it was actually the Green Lantern special in Final Night, because I recently read this. That's why it's sticking out in my head. But I remember that was, like, one of the first major things that he did for DC back in the day. And his art style is actually very consistent from then. He's not one of those artists that changes his style on a regular basis. This is pretty much what Mike McCone looks like, and I really love his art.
I was going to say, I'd be very frustrated if he did change his style, because I really like what he's doing.
Right.
I guess to be more clear is he's got a very nice, clean style, mm-hmm. but it doesn't jump off the page at me. You know, it's good, solid art. Mm-hmm. And what I'm saying is before you pointed him out to me, mm-hmm. right here, you know, a couple of minutes ago,
yeah,
I read all those Fantastic Four issues. I read all those issues.
Okay.
And his name was not a name that was jumping out at me. Even when I read this wedding special and, you know, we reviewed it and everything, it wasn't like McCone was like jumping out at me. But now that you mention it and I've given it a little extra thought right here in this past couple of minutes, now I will note him. But it's not something that had occurred to me before.
Well, I'm glad to hear it.
But you've got a good point there, Bob, because while it's a very good, clean style, it's not like a signature style where there's something that you look at and say, aha, that's McCone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it doesn't have like Kevin Maguire's facial expressions.
Right.
Or some other thing that is highly identifiable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The only thing that actually really, I guess, I always know it's Mike McCone art, he has a certain style to his faces that I think probably sets him apart from other people, but it's certainly much more subtle than, like you said, like a Maguire or somebody like that. I can't exactly put my finger on it. Maybe it's just a bit more angular than some other people actually draw it, but that's usually the first thing that I'm like, my eyes go straight to his faces.
I'll agree with you there on the faces, but I'll disagree with you on the angular part. I think he's a little more – his faces tend to be a little more rounded.
Okay.
Than, you know, less sharp, like the lines and stuff. And he doesn't use like all of the cheekbone lines and the jaw lines and all this other stuff that other guys may be. He's really subtle.
Yeah.
As you said.
Yeah. Well, let's actually go into the writing to go from the art to the writing. This was Dwayne McDuffie's, again, first issue on Justice League as the regular writer of Justice League. And before this, he was on Fantastic Four. I guess there's a running trend here of people going from Fantastic Four to Justice League, at least for this here. But Dwayne McDuffie, he's written for the animated series before, and I believe he did do Justice League in the past, correct? The actual comic book? Or am I remembering that wrong?
I think you're wrong.
He did the Justice League cartoon. I don't know that he's ever done the comic before.
Okay. All right.
Maybe he was associated with
Network
like
one.
The JL Unlimited, maybe.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, cool.
He might have done it most an issue or two, not like any kind of a run before or anything, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, was this a smooth transition for you from what was brought before with Brad Meltzer's run to what the Justice League sounded like and I guess maybe felt like here? Was it a smooth transition for you guys?
Was it a smooth transition or not? I would say in some ways very much so, in other ways not so much.
Mm-hmm.
To me, this was kind of a smooth transition into what I would consider kind of a classic era Justice League, which for me is kind of the later satellite era.
Okay.
It's got that feel where we actually see the people out of costume hanging out with each other. We get a feel for the interpersonal dynamics and stuff. And as much as I liked a lot of what Brad Meltzer did, I thought it was lacking in some of those areas. This, I think, was a good follow-on, a great follow-on, really, to Brad Meltzer's run. But I think, particularly in this issue, it really surpassed it in many respects.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to have to totally agree with John there. For me, you know, I'd like the Meltzer run on JLA, but to me, this was a breath of fresh air. You know, after all of the manic intercutting and confusing narration boxes, you know, like Meltzer's run, Superman's narration box was either yellow with red lines, and then Wonder Woman's was like red with yellow lines, something like that. I couldn't tell whose was whose, and this got rid of all that, just made it real easy to read. And, you know, we got a couple pages of story, you know, in one location at a time. We didn't go from like the bachelor party to the firestorm scene and then to the villains all on one page. The pages had a natural flow to them, and it lacked that television-y intercutting that Meltzer stuff has.
Right.
And I really like that.
Less epic and more comic book. I guess that's how I'm looking at it here. It's certainly, I don't know, it's just more at home for me. Like, more something that I could probably read over and over again, while Brad Meltzer's is just, oh, hey, that's pretty good, and then I just move on to the next thing. I read this issue about four times.
I would argue this is more epic than a lot of Meltzer stuff. Meltzer stuff is more summer blockbuster movie type. It's great. It's fun the first time or two.
Mm-hmm.
But then it's like, okay, been there, done that. You know, this, I think, has a lot more depth.
Yeah. And Bob, how about you?
I really like the way he does dialogue. I think his interaction between the characters it's a nice, clean, casual style to the conversation. Even with the villain Trinity, the way that the interplay between them when they're talking, the interplay between any of these characters, it just seems more classic Justice League back from, you know, you have to go way back, you know, to probably the satellite era of the Justice League, in my opinion, to get just clean, fun interplay of dialogue like this.
Right.
And that's what I'm really enjoying about this. You know, Meltzer, he did a fine job of writing, but it just wasn't the same.
Yeah, well, you can pretty much tell, actually, from these opening pages where they're at the table, the villains are at the table choosing who's going to be a part of their Injustice League, that fun feel is there, because I'd actually kind of be afraid to see how Brad Meltzer would write the Joker on a regular basis. Just like I'd be afraid to see how he'd write Lex Luthor on a regular basis. Because I don't know if he'd be able to get them as characters. In these first three pages, I knew Dwayne McDuffie knew these characters. He knew how they were supposed to feel and talk and act, and that I was going to be in for some fun.
Exactly, and how to act with each other and the interplay between each other. Mm-hmm. He just has it down. He's really good like that. He does the same thing with the FF characters when in his writing over in Fantastic Four.
Right.
He mm-hmm. just has that group, the ability to write a group of characters down really well.
I think that's it right there. It's a group of characters. Whereas a lot of like Meltzer's stuff is more plot centric than character centric, mm-hmm. and certainly there's a lot of plot in here, and there are certainly characters in Meltzer's stuff, but it's a matter of focus and what really pulls you in, and a good plot is great, but if it's fun characters, interesting characters, and a really good interplay between the characters, that's what really sucks you in and gets you totally engrossed in a story.
Yeah. It shows that the last thing that Dwayne McDuffie wrote before this was Fantastic Four, because the Fantastic Four are family. And right here, these characters, oddly enough, both the villains and the actual heroes, there were at times a sense of family going on there. You know, a very, very, I guess, evil family when it comes to the villains. But for the heroes, you could tell that these guys are people that, again, like we said earlier, hang out outside of the costume, have known each other for years, can talk to each other like human beings, not just superheroes. There's a togetherness that you just didn't get with Meltzer. Now, going into the actual issue here, well, we start off with the whole scene with the strippers asking for their money, and of course, what's the first thing that Hal Jordan turns to but Batman? The guy with the deep pockets. However, I'm not quite sure if he has that much of familiarity with strippers, but then again, Bruce Wayne might, so who knows?
It'd have to be bat strippers.
Now, do you think the sum of $3,600 coming from Green Lantern is any kind of a reference to how many sectors there are in the galaxy for the Green Lantern Corps? Or just coincidence?
You know, it might be a coincidence, who knows? But it's Dwayne McDuffie, so you never know. Do you think they intentionally got that number off the top of their head? Who knows? I don't know. But
it just seems like an exorbitant amount of money for that many strippers.
You can only get a stripper for $1 each out in all those sectors of space.
Oh, boy. What were you going to say?
No, come on. You know, if it was $5,200, people would be saying, 52, 52.
Hey, well, look, I think my favorite line in the entire thing is on the next page after that. The whole thing about, okay, fine, the strippers need the money. And I have to keep Ollie from finding out about it because he doesn't want any strippers. Yes, but how could you possibly know that?
I'm Batman.
He did say that, didn't he? I like the, I'm not coming to the party, you're coming to me. Yeah. That was my favorite line.
Yeah, and this felt like Batman to me. I mean, this didn't feel like just a character in like the bat suit. This was the Batman I'd known to grow and love, and actually felt a bit like the JLU Batman.
So yeah.
You could tell where Dwayne McDuffie had written Batman before this. That much was pretty much a given there. Moving on from there, this is actually something that I got to bring up here. How stupid must be to think that there aren't going to be a bunch of paparazzi outside of a public place when you plan a bachelor party for a superhero?
Who tipped them off?
they probably found out like through like a random source. I mean, who knows? Who, you know what? Snapper Carr. Since everybody finds out,
I'm thinking
Snapper
Bruce.
Carr. That could be. Yeah, actually, I wouldn't be surprised by that. Just to get him to have it in the place where he thought they should have it. But shouldn't they have had it in the Hall of Justice in the first place, or somewhere like that, where they wouldn't have to worry about the press finding something like this and ruining all of their secret identities at once?
Well, if you're initially planning to have some hot strippers on over, you probably don't want to have it in the Hall of Justice where, you know, Wonder Woman could come walking in at any time.
True, but isn't she going to be at
the bachelorette? How prudent is that going to be? Well, but, you know.
I mean, at the bachelorette party at the time, that's what I was under the you know, the assumption of, that the bachelorette and bachelor party were happening at the same time.
Yeah, but they didn't have the bachelorette party at the Hall of Justice, and there was like all kinds of male strippers dancing around at that thing.
True.
Double standard.
Well, I
double
guess.
Standard. I hate those.
At the same time, though, Oracle planned the bachelorette party. That's why they should have just had Batman plan the bachelor party. Because when
I think he did.
Yeah.
He just didn't tell them.
Which I guess is a very Batman thing to do. But, yeah, we move on from there. And right again, you know, congratulations, Ollie, all that. Yeah. Go ahead and say what? I told you so? I did, didn't I?
I love that part, too.
Yeah, well, this whole thing, and again, going back to the whole family feel here, it's like every word out of these guys' mouths is something that you'd expect a regular person to say. That's what draws me to characters, when they feel real. Like, it doesn't feel stiff, like it's been, like, pre-recorded, and you're playing it back. You know, these are real words coming out of everybody's mouths.
Yeah.
Let's see. There was one other line here on this particular page that just absolutely had me cracking up. Yeah, that's how he tries to lower his score on the Kinsey scale. Really, what's the other part? Sleeping with Black Canary repeatedly. All right, that's practically your mother you're talking about. Show some respect. That's banter you expect to hear between, like, Green Arrow and his son, because you know that the son's going to know exactly how to push the buttons of the father.
I'd like to see them do a good buddy miniseries with Roy and Connor.
Well, that would be a lot of fun.
They haven't really interacted that much, have they, in the comics, or have I just not read those?
They've done a bit here and there in the Green Arrow stuff, but nothing where it's just those two really kind of establishing a solid, you know, relationship as kind of sort of brothers, but not quite. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. They did it with Mia a lot. Like, they had Connor go on missions with Mia, and they had Roy go on missions with Mia, but never Roy and Connor at the same place at the same time. You'd think that they'd want to hang out, since they are so close and family-like, but I don't know. Hasn't happened yet. Now, the next page, I think, is actually pretty important here, because this was one of the main things I didn't get from reading JOA 13 first, and that's the handing over of the Green Lantern ship of the JOA from Hal to John, because all of a sudden, in Justice League of America number 13, there's John Stewart as the Green Lantern, and I'm like, did Dwayne McDuffie do this off-screen? What's going on? Then I actually read the wedding special and found out that's why it was there. It's a very important moment that you'd probably want to at least put a little, like, star next to in Justice League of America number 13 to say, you know, see the wedding special to find out why this character is here.
Okay, speaking of why this character is here on this page, I've got three quick questions.
Okay.
Let's start with the bottom right panel.
Mm-hmm.
The guy on the very left... Who is that? Behind Metamorpho.
That looks like John Constantine.
That was the guess I was going to have. But
he's got dark hair. Constantine's blonde.
This is the one from the movie.
Yeah, this is Keanu Reeves.
Whoa.
Yes.
I mean, so that was one that I couldn't figure out who was. And then there's...
Who's the guy with the bubble
on his head?
You
know who that is? He's on... You go back a couple of pages. He's Zatara.
Oh, okay.
He's standing right next to Flash. If you go back to the big
no, that's Starman because he's got the goggles.
No.
Yeah, you go back with the Flash Superman and the congratulations Ollie scene.
We still have a Starman.
Oh, maybe it is that.
Yeah, that's Starman because he has the goggles, and it can't be the same guy unless he put his tie on in between scenes.
Oh yeah,
I was unaware we still had a Starman.
Yeah, I thought something happened to Starman.
No, he's still
around.
And
then the guy on the one page, with the yellow suit and the space thing, that's not Space Cabby. It's not Space Ranger. Who is that? It's one of the really obscure sci-fi heroes that hasn't seen much press in a few decades, I think.
I'm just going to go with Doublehead Guy.
Okay.
I mean, Bob, I'm looking to you on this. You would know this guy.
I have no idea who that is.
He's in Who's Who. I know that much. I can't remember. I don't do trivia.
Bubblehead Guy it is. Let's just go with Bubblehead Guy.
I do trivia, just not this trivia. But then you go up to the center panel here. Mm-hmm. We got Adam Strange.
Right.
This goes back to when is this happening compared to everything else in the universe right now? Because we've got three of the Earth-based Green Lanterns accounted for in this whole thing. It doesn't matter either way. Well, it's just kind of funny seeing
some bad stuff's there. Happening to Adam Strange out on Ran in that Countdown to Adventure book,
and I've
there's no way he's going to be back on Earth for the wedding.
Yeah,
I want to know why Blue Beetle is here. He's not 21.
Well,
turn back a page.
Know,
he's talking to Cyborg.
So that, but if you go back another page, talking to
who's Wildcat? Talking to Wildcat? Yeah.
That's Black Condor. But I think that's like two or three Black Condors back.
You're right, yeah. And haven't they all been killed according to Freedom Fighters?
That's how long Mike McCone's been gone from the DC Universe.
I guess. I don't know. Maybe that one just retired. But hey, how about Ryan Choi being there? Because Ryan Choi's got his own stuff happening in Atom right now. That's why, like, when there's these huge gatherings like this, it's so difficult to put it in continuity. So difficult to point out when the hell this is taking place.
It's 3 hours on any given day, you know.
That the editor should see the script coming in, and McDuffie's got this thing with, you know, hey, have some people in the background, presumably. And the editor should know who's available to be there.
Yeah.
And fix that. Because, I mean, like, I'm not even sure Hawkman is Earth-based around this time for this. Mm-hmm. Now, he might have come back just for this whatever.
Right.
But,
yeah.
You know,
I don't know why he would come back for this, given his past relationship with Black Canary.
Because of his past relationship with Ollie. I mean, those two were always at each other's throats or whatever, but, I mean, they were, you know, core Justice Leaguers together for ages.
Yeah, I mean, they're still friendly, even though they don't, like see eye to eye.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But just going back to the whole Jon Stewart and Hal Jordan thing, is this just Dwayne McDuffie bringing on Jon Stewart because it's like it's his pet character, the one that he helped grow in JLU, or is there actually reasoning behind putting Jon Stewart in there other than the obvious?
Well, I think it's probably a little bit of both.
I really wouldn't go with the pet character theory. It may be one he's just more comfortable with or likes better.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, referring to it as the pet character, I don't know, just seems... Like John doesn't belong in the Justice League.
Well, all right. Yeah, let me rephrase that. But what I meant specifically is that, like, it's the character that he helped mold in JLU. So now I'm wondering whether or not he brought him on here to try and mold him in his image here in Justice League of America.
It's possible, but it also could be that maybe when McDuffie really got into Green Lantern, it was when John was Green Lantern.
Point. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Bob, you agree with that?
I think that it could very well be. Now, this is the flip side of the editor is not really paying attention to who should and shouldn't be on this page, but maybe there is some foresight into what's going to happen to Hal vis-a-vis the Sinestro Corps War, and they're kind of setting it up so that we don't have Hal tied up with the Justice League because he's got a lot of stuff to do with the Green Lantern Corps.
Mm-hmm.
That's just a guess.
Yeah,
could be.
Well, John's in there as well.
Yeah, but he's not as central. I mean, Green Lantern is Hal Jordan's book, and you know the other characters are kind of incidental at this point.
And to me, I thought it should have been John Stewart in this new JLA anyway. I mean, they're bringing in a whole bunch of like characters that have never been on before, really, or needed a spotlight. So I didn't really understand why Hal was brought on. I guess, you know, Meltzer grew up with Hal, but I'm glad to see that John's on the team now. I mean, Hal's got his own book. Kyle did. You know, Guy Gardner, Green Lantern Corps is basically his book. So,
yeah.
And John's been out of the spotlight since Infinite Crisis. You know, he was undercover or whatever in Green Lantern, and we didn't see much of that.
And Countdown, so let him be. Countdown's like Kyle's current book, really.
Right. So let him stay on. Let him be on this team and in this book. That's fine. Because yeah. I'd like to see a bit more of him.
Hey, I mean, they are doing a good job of putting a place for all of the Green Lanterns out there. Like, nobody's being left behind.
And that's how you don't forget about characters and continue to like them. And that's going to keep the I think that's going to keep the Green Lantern franchise going, if they give all of them equal exposure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's kind of probably the best thought right there, because Hal's in Green Lantern, Guy Gardner's in Green Lantern Corps, Kyle's in Countdown, and now... And I'm sure they'll do something with them after Countdown, and now you put John in Justice League, so they each have their own relatively separate spotlight thing on a regular basis. I like that idea.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. And there's a lot to be said for keeping characters in play, because if you go to the next page, we see Firestorm really for one of the first times since his series ended.
Yeah. Then, what was it, 2 weeks? Well, actually, a little longer than that. It was about a month afterwards that he showed up in Countdown.
Yeah.
But until then, this was the first time. And, of course, it's written by Dwayne McDuffie, which is something I love seeing. I really adore the way he writes Firestorm.
Mm-hmm.
And, for that matter, I'd sort of like to see him on the Justice League.
Oh, same here.
Yeah. In a way, it would bridge the gap between that, you know, very failed version of the Justice League that took place during 52 and... Well, the current bigwigs, just like Firestorm was the small fry in the group back in the, what was it, the 80s, I guess, when he was on the group, now you would be able to have this Firestorm learn from the best, which I think would probably work very well for him as a character. So who knows?
Well, and again, it goes back to echoing that part of the satellite era.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So. Yeah, definitely. And, well, the fight scene here also proves that Firestorm still has a lot to learn. You're taking on a bunch of villains at once, and it's just you. And he seemed to have much more confidence than he should have here, that he was going to be able to take all of these guys on at the same time.
Well, it wouldn't be very heroic if when he saw the Joker, Lex, and Cheetah, that he just, you know, turned tail and run.
Well,
it'd be understandable, but it wouldn't be very heroic.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm going to call, like, a gym line here, and, well, he could have at least tried to call for reinforcements.
Yes, and he should have.
Yes, yes, especially with what happens to him with the Joker gas and all that. And very disturbing sight to see Firestorm with a forced laughing smile on his face. Again, that's
could be worse.
It could be a hell of a lot worse, but that's another point where the art really worked for me. Keith puts the menace on there incredibly well, and... That combined with Joker wearing that trench coat and the hat again, that's one of my favorite looks for Joker. That's the one that I think like makes him look the most threatening to me. So it just, all these visuals came apart very well for me. But I'm going to skip forward here a little bit so we're not like focusing on this for the entire time, but the Legion of Doom headquarters is the Injustice League headquarters. So yet again bringing in an element from JLU into the book here, but...
Well, I mean, going
back
to Super Friends.
And Super Friends, yes. But now they both have their original headquarters for the Super Friends in canon now, which is pretty fun.
Yeah.
I got that guy in the helmet for you. I've been paging through my Who's Who.
Space Ranger?
Space Ranger. It is indeed Space Ranger.
Oh, okay.
Rick Starr.
Excellent. Okay, he's no longer just helmet dude.
Nope. First appearance, showcase number 15.
Who else here is a fan of the Legion of Doom headquarters, specifically the look of it? You know, the whole Darth Vader helmet thing.
I like it. It's a callback to the Super Friends.
Seriously, though, it's hard to not look at that and think, Luke, I am your father.
Well, the thing that's always gotten me about that, you know, look for that headquarters is if you look at the buildings across the street from the San Diego Convention Center, on the west end of the Convention Center.
Mm-hmm.
The bottom of the towers looks just like that.
And if you walk about 8 or 9 blocks away from the San Diego Convention Center, you make your way to the Hall of Justice. I don't know if you realize that, John. There's an actual Hall of Justice not that far away from the San Diego Convention Center.
Yeah, but it doesn't look the least bit like.
A little bit. With the stone pillars, it looks a little bit like it. Or maybe I'm just trying very hard to make it look like that in my head.
I think you're trying very hard.
Okay.
But yeah.
I would think having lived there for 20 years, I would have noticed such a building.
All right, cool.
Catch you there.
Point. All right.
Now, if you go to the next page past Legion Doom, you get this beautiful two-page spread of the villains.
Yeah.
This is just nice stuff.
Yeah, and the first utterance of the Injustice League Unlimited.
Mm-hmm.
And when I read that, I could actually imagine the Justice League Unlimited theme playing backwards in my head.
Come on, Bob, you should get that joke.
I got it.
Welcome to Time.
Is that supposed to be Grodd in the bottom right corner? That's a
it's not very well done.
An extremely runty looking Grodd.
That's the only character that looks off model here, really. Now, the guy in the trench coat with the scruffy beard, standing next to Giganta,
and Simon,
is that Vandal Savage or is that somebody else?
No,
I was thinking Mammoth.
Mammoth? Okay.
It's got, what is, I guess that's just a regular belt. First I thought that was an E, but I think that's just a regular belt.
Yeah. Who's the guy in the business suit way up in the left corner there?
Oh.
Kind of by Dr. Light.
Isn't that Psycho?
That's a short little dude.
Yeah.
Yes, he's got a mustache and a kind of crazed look about him. Bigger mustache.
I would almost say Deadshot, but Deadshot should be in costume. It's not Toyman, or Prankster, because that's by, he's by Killer Frost.
Oh, wait, isn't that the, is that the guy from Crime Bible and all that, from Intergang?
Mannheim?
Mannheim, yeah.
Okay. Sure.
Maybe.
Yeah, because his design looks a little familiar to the way Mannheim looked in the animated series. That's why I'm just thinking that.
Yeah, I'm thinking that guy without the shirt maybe is supposed to be Man. Well, no, because isn't this guy over by just above and to the right of Deathstroke? That's Mammoth.
You're right. That's Mammoth. My mistake.
Okay.
He's had a few different looks, so that's classic Mammoth over there.
I'm thinking maybe that's his new Shaggy Man.
No, because that's behind Jinx or whatever by Clayface and Mysteries.
Oh, yeah, he is.
Yep. Never mind.
Right above Jinx. Yeah.
Yep. Okay. He's just officially known as Shirtless Guy.
Who's this silhouette with the kind of flat head right in front of Luthor, below him to the right?
I don't know. I'm also not sure about the guy in front of him.
That's Major Guile from Street Fighter.
Well, I thought the flat guy was going to be like Shadow Thief or whatever.
Not with that head.
True.
Hammerhead?
He looks like an AIM agent got a hold of Shadow Thief's technology.
See, and that's why, like, earlier I didn't want to say that the guy that we were, like, didn't know who it was at the bachelor party was Pete Wisdom, considering that it looked just like him. But, all right, if we're going to do crossovers like that, then fine, it's an AIM agent with Shadow Thief technology. And I'm also very happy to see Effigy is in this, because as a Kyle fan, Effigy is, like, one of my favorite villains from his rogues gallery. So it's nice to see that they're going.
What, you don't like Major Force?
No, I like Major Force, but I also like Effigy. Effigy, I think, was, I mean, Major Force was a bit severe. Effigy was more calculating, I guess.
Effigy's the pale white guy by Cheetah.
No, Effigy is
flying.
The red guy with the flames.
Flying by guy by Giganta.
The Firestorm.
The Firestorm looking guy.
Right.
I like Fatality.
Yeah, Fatality's always been fun. And she's actually pretty prevalent later on in this. But, yeah, so the rest of this is just, you know, the typical, like, party and all that, which I guess we could skip through until...
On the next page, though, that's a really freaky-looking male stripper that Dinah and Fire are getting down with there.
He likes the movie 300, I guess.
Yeah, I guess. He's got that 300 crest on his cloak and the weird mask and the whole thing.
Like, hey, baby, this is...
They're Florida. Like, you know... Ollie's saying, hey, I'm not going to have some strippers. And they're like getting down with this dude in a little G-string and a cape and stuff. So he should have kept those strippers.
I'm not very surprised by the fact that they had strippers, though, because it goes with Dinah's character. While Ollie's trying to, you know, act all like grown up with his, I could see that Dinah, because she already feels grown up, would just be letting it loose and, you know, saying like, hey, one more time, you know, before I'm hitched.
I like the fact that this one stripper guy with the big fro, that's a wig. He takes it off when he brings him outside.
Yeah.
And the place they're in is called the Meat Locker.
In the seedy part of town.
Right. Yeah, but
that is a seedy looking part of town.
Very seedy. But yeah, he's the one who tells him about a firestorm, which is the beginning of the whole trap thing, and then Batman finds out about Firestorm and brings Red Arrow with him, and just zooming past that to where they actually, you know, go into Firestorm's room. I'm very happy that they didn't go a bit farther with this. I was afraid for his life the first time that I read this.
Can I go back to that stripper guy?
Yeah.
I don't understand.
Yeah.
If you're working and you're a male stripper and you got all these superheroines in your club, are you really going to take a phone call from your sister? Come on.
Well, maybe he thought it was important. Maybe she was pregnant. I'm just trying to give him reasons here, so I'm just going to...
You just killed it right there.
Ah, dude, come on. He's got his sister in his heart, always, even when he's stripping.
He must be gay or something.
Moving on. Yes.
On the next page, I want to know what the guy is shouting at the Aquaman about.
Yeah.
Look at the look on his face. He got his fist raised up.
You're not the real Aquaman.
Hey, baby, what's your sign?
I really like the interplay between Batman and Roy.
Yeah, well, it's a sign that Batman knows that he's... Well, obviously, he already knew this, but he's treating Roy like an adult. Like he's one of the group like he should be.
More or less treating him like Nightwing. I mean, to a certain degree.
Mm-hmm. Well, he's known him forever now, considering how close Nightwing and Roy have been over the years.
Yeah, but one of the last times these two guys had any kind of storyline or whatever was in, I guess it was Batman plus Arsenal or whatever. And the relationship was, let's say, less respectful from Batman's perspective.
Yeah.
He was much harder on Roy.
Well, I'm trying to remember in The Outsiders, he thought he was having interaction with Batman in Outsiders.
Right.
Yeah, but a little bit of spoilers here for Outsiders. It turned out to be Deathstroke, so I guess that didn't really add to their friendship that much. It's like, you know me well enough where you thought Deathstroke was me?
I like Roy in Justice League better than I ever did him in Outsiders. He seems a lot more mature.
I'm with you on that.
He's being better used.
Mm-hmm. And Outsiders has just never really worked right for me, because Outsiders with the whole dual leadership thing just like felt like neither one of them got enough time as they should.
Mm-hmm. I think just switching from Arsenal to Red Arrow was a transition for the character, and that is marked by how he's acting differently.
Right.
Yeah.
And that was Shadow Thief, I think, in that two-page spread, because you get a little bit farther on where Geo-Force is getting smacked down. Mm-hmm. You got Shadow Thief in the background there, and he's got kind of an angular, flat look to parts of his head.
So, was anybody else worried about Firestorm's safety when they read this for the first time, or was I the only one who thought that perhaps he was going to bite the bullet?
I thought it was a possibility, but given that it was Dwayne McDuffie writing, I didn't really think they'd kill him off.
No one else can write him but me, I get rid of him. The shit hits the fan after that, really. Like you said, with Geo-Force. And yet again, somebody who doesn't call for backup.
What the hell is going on with Geo-Force? I don't even remember anymore.
Well, isn't...
Because it was never really made clear in JLA 12 whatever happened there.
He's working both sides, right?
I don't understand how. I mean, like, Meltzer never really set up anything in his issues to do that. And then in number 12, all of a sudden he's meeting with Deathstroke. And then now Deathstroke's beating the crap out of him. It seems like we're missing something here. Mm-hmm. To me, anyway.
I guess Deathstroke knows that he never was really working with him in the first place?
I guess. I don't know.
I mean... Are you guys any more familiar with that than we are?
No. I always thought that Geo-Force's inclusion in the current Justice League was kind of odd. He just seemed to sort of be there, but not really be a core member of the team.
Mm-hmm. He didn't seem to belong there.
Yeah.
Well, he did sort of tack him on at the last minute.
Geo-Force is the kind of guy, he's fine in something like The Outsiders, but he is not Justice League material.
Yeah. And from the looks of things, he might be going to the Outsiders after that first arc. So cross your fingers on that. We might be getting rid of him soon. Just as the rest of the issue goes, ambush and all that, and I'm just skipping ahead here because the actual wedding stuff is pretty much done with at this point. They let Hawkgirl go, and she's the one who lets everybody at the bachelor party know that the ambush has happened. And obviously Superman's like, let's go to work. And this leads directly into Justice League of America number 13 at this point here. Again, the issue as a whole, I don't know. I was expecting something so different that when I read it for the first time, my jaw just sort of dropped. It's like, why is this called what it was? We've been through this before, but I was sort of hoping that even the ending would get back to the whole wedding thing a little bit.
Did your jaw drop because you were surprised that it was an actual story and not just some weird wedding issue?
Actually, yes.
Because that's how I felt.
Yeah.
I think that they really did a stupid thing here because I think this issue sold way worse mm-hmm. than it would have if they would have advertised it properly.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I think there are lots of people that did not get this because it was, you know, it's just like, okay, it's yet another crappy wedding crossover. How many of those do we need to read, you know?
But, I mean, that says something about kind of the long-term output of both Marvel and DC, really, that people saw this sort of a thing as extraneous and superfluous, when in this particular case it was not. But based solely on that expectation, the title and the cover and stuff, it's like, no, I don't need to get this. It was a very common reaction.
Yeah. It's actually sort of similar to how I felt about Countdown at times, where Countdown would reference things that hadn't even finished yet or things that hadn't even happened yet. It feels like at times, which was exemplified by this issue here, that DC doesn't know where they're going.
I think they have an idea where they're going. I think that what they're trying to do is pretty big in scope at times, and they're having a hard time getting a handle on it. I mean, clearly this had a definite trajectory on and part to play in the overall publishing plan for DC. It's just the marketing department didn't really seem to maybe understand what that was.
Well, Brent, I mean, did this make you feel any different about the DCU after reading this? Like, where it's heading, that sort of stuff?
Not really the whole DCU, but it made me more confident that Justice League is finally going to shape it up and be exciting month to month rather than every 2 or 3 months.
Okay. Yeah. So you were happy with the fact that it actually meant something in the end?
Oh, yeah. I was perfectly happy.
Okay.
If that's a word.
It is. It is. Now it is. Congratulations, sir.
Yay.
Yay. Yeah, and Bob, I'm assuming you were happy as well.
Oh, yeah. I looked at this and said, okay, you know, Justice League is going to be top of the pile again. If, you know, Dwayne McDuffie is going to write the monthly book and, you know, issue 13 was just as good, you know, it says, if he's going to write the book like this, hey, I'm right there.
All right, well, moving on to the actual wedding special, which is, yet again, the Green Arrow and Black Canary wedding special, the first issue. The writer was Judd Winnick, and the art was by Amanda Connor, and the colors for this one were by Paul Mounts, Elizabeth Gerlin, yet again, assistant editor, Ken Lopez, letters, Mike Carlin, Justice of the Peace, according to the liner here, and Tom Palmer Jr. as associate editor. So I'm glad that they had Mike Carlin as Justice of the Peace so they could actually do it that way.
Wait, what?
What, you didn't catch that? No, Mike Carlin is listed as Justice of the Peace for the issue.
I don't get it.
That's, you know, wedding, Justice of the Peace.
Uh-uh.
Someone who may perform a wedding, Brent.
Yeah.
He's the editor-in-chief. Anyway.
He's not the editor-in-chief.
For this issue. He's, you know, just the overseeing editor.
Yes.
Mike Carlin.
Yes. He's the one who...
Justice of the Peace.
Yeah. Just like...
Is that what non-religious people use instead of a priest or a pastor or something?
Correct.
Yeah.
For a civil ceremony, you use a Justice of the Peace.
All right. I did not know that.
For me, would be Mike Carlin, rabbi. You know, for other people, it would be Mike Carlin, you know, priest or pastor. And Justice of the Peace is just the non-denominational one.
Oh, okay. So you learn something new every time on Comic Timing.
Time after time.
Or at least I do.
Yeah. Now we know, and knowing is half the battle, G.I. Joe. All right. So, yeah, I'll start off with the same thing I asked the last time. The art on this, I'm a huge Amanda Connor fan. I think she even lends a little bit to, like, a Maguire style, even.
The faces, yeah. I mean, I was thinking that same thing when you see how she does some of these facial expressions. She does a really nice job on capturing something there.
Yeah. And
especially,
like,
with the eyes.
Yeah, and Superman's face in this you'd swear that he was like Shazam, you know, like this like little kid in big man's clothing. Every single time she draws him, he's got this like little kid's grin, like, well, I think they're going to make a good couple. And like you can imagine him shuffling his feet and like rubbing his ear or something like that. Yeah, like I said, the art in general works very well for me. And yeah, Brent, same for you.
Oh, by far. This is the first real piece of Amanda Carner art I've ever read outside of just the Power Girl covers and stuff. So I really like her stuff now. And boy, we should do more regular work, right?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
So what I want to understand is when Zatanna screams out, "Ecat tifo ibab," why all the male strippers' clothes don't all go whipping off, fly out the door. Still have clothes on. That's she's using her magic there.
Because
look at the next page. The guy wearing the exclamation point is covering himself, and he's like, "Where did my clothes go?"
I think he's just shaking his butt and fire his face there. But
okay, hold on, let's see here. I have to
The next page.
So it's the center page. Just go to the staples.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. His underwear left.
Yeah.
He's scared.
Oh, okay, that guy down there. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, but then go to the next page, second panel. Afro guy is third from the left. Different costume.
Well, now it looks like Black Lightning's costume instead of a Black Lightning ripoff.
He didn't have lightning bolts at all before.
Isn't that kind of creepy that he's dancing with thunder?
Yeah.
well, just like Hawk Girl is dancing with little like Hawk Lad there.
Well, that's a little different. That's not your dad.
Exclamation point guy has got his underpants back on the next page on at the bottom panel. Where,
but that's a different exclamation point.
Okay, is there a different one?
Yeah.
She's sticking a dollar in him.
Hey,
that's blue and red rather than red and
purple. We're getting to a point where we're like analyzing these male strippers like way too much for me.
I'm just thoroughly amused by the male stripper Green Arrow that's in there.
Yeah.
Yeah, because
he needs to be a part of the Village People, that guy, I'm telling you.
Yeah. All right. So let's go back to the beginning here. Okay.
What was the issue that showed this from yet another angle?
Where, it was one of the countdown ones.
Countdown.
Yeah, where Stargirl and
Wonder Girl.
Wonder Girl are Supergirl. Trying to sneak in and see the
Yeah,
the
that
male
was Countdown.
Strippers.
That was Countdown.
Okay.
That was the same issue, if I remember correctly, where Trickster and Piper were locked away.
Now, on one last thing, I'm going to go to the other gender because in this double page spread, or not double page, but on the center spread here where the staple is,
mm-hmm.
on the upper left one, congrats, Ollie, keep the arrow in its quiver. There's a good 15 strippers on this page.
Yeah.
So you only saw three of them in that other one, but here's your $3,600 worth of strippers right here.
This makes a lot more sense to me.
You got the one in the cat outfit here. And
yeah, well, you got to be a really high-class stripper.
You got a cowgirl and an Indian, and you got one who looks kind of like Harley Quinn. You got a Poison Ivy one.
Mm-hmm. You know, going back to this opening montage that's on the first, I guess, double pages here, and I think what I especially enjoy about Amanda Connor's art here is the subtle differences from panel to panel, where it almost looks like she's using the art style that I guess is as similar as possible as she could get to the art from those actual panels the first time around, because every one looks slightly different to me, especially with the one shot on the Miraculously, where Dinah's meeting Green Arrow for the first time after he came back. Like, that looks very Phil Hester to me.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a sign of a good artist to me. Somebody who can actually work her style around what she's given. That's brilliant. And with this opening montage as well, did that sort of thing work for you, to telling the story of their long relationship in a matter of two pages?
It was a good recap.
It gave you the sense of, like, the ups and downs that they've been through so that you can understand all, you know, a couple pages after where you see everybody getting their invites and all their different reactions. You can understand where those reactions are coming from. And it adds a little bit of drama and stuff to what happens at the end.
Right.
You can. It lets you know if you're reading this for the first time that they've been through a lot, so that the ending is particularly tragic.
Now, I have a question for you guys. When you read curses in comic books that are all like at mark and like and sign and percentage mark and all that, Do you hear a bleep in your head, or do you fill in the curse?
I just stick in the universal adjective whenever I see that.
Okay.
I fill it in.
I read out the punctuation marks.
And
I find it really slows down the story.
So I must be out of my at number number dollar percent or percentage mind.
Yeah, and it never makes sense to me. It throws the whole rhythm off.
Good times.
When Canary's going after her wedding ring, I added an ing to the end of it.
There you go. Yeah, well, that's like, are you out? Yeah, so I must be out of my bleeping mind.
Right.
Yeah, you got to definitely add the favorite word in there.
Well, it fits there. There's the same amount of symbols as there are letters in effing.
Yeah. Now, this whole exchange in general, where they're, like, yelling at each other, and then he even brings up, like, maybe we should go rustle up one of your old dance partners, Hawkman, Ra's al Ghul, the U.S. Navy, and then...
I don't know. Can you recap the Ra's al Ghul thing? Because that was something new to me.
Oh, I don't...
Go back to that double-page spread. Mm-hmm. Second row, first column.
Okay. What happened, though? Like is there an overview that you can give
me? It was one of the arcs of Birds of Prey.
Oh, okay.
It's like one of the early ones, right? I think like the second or third?
Thereabouts, yeah.
Yeah. I think it's traded. I'm not entirely certain about that, but...
I'm almost certain it is.
Yeah.
I can't imagine it's not.
Okay. Yeah, but I that's actually before I started reading Birds of Prey, so I wouldn't be able to tell you about that. But if Bob or John know any more about it and want to share, the floor is yours.
Oh, well, I read it when it first came out. She was hanging out with him on the yacht or whatever. She basically, you know, kind of sort of hooked up with him for a bit at the time, not really realizing, I think, who it was.
Mm-hmm. She was undercover, right? She was undercover, yeah. And it was just kind of a thing. And she wasn't with Ollie at the time, so I don't think.
That works.
And she didn't know it was Ra's al Ghul. There was something going on where it was like, you know, it wasn't like, hey, I'm Ra's al Ghul, let's hook up.
Right. And this exchange back and forth here is probably a dividing line for some folks, because I'm a huge Judd Winnick fan. This is Judd Winnick writing. And there are people out there who aren't nearly as huge a fan of Judd Winnick's writing that would probably look at this exchange here and say, oh, that's so forced. But I think it was very much in character for them. I think that this was like running the money. I mean, are we all Judd Winnick fans here, or is there anybody out there that doesn't like him?
I like Judd Winnick's writing. I mean, I like the Green Arrow stuff. I loved the Red Hood stuff, but this part did feel a little weird for me. And I've been reading Green Arrow for the past 12 issues before that series ended.
Right.
But that part did feel just a little weird. But I guess if you fought as much as they have, then they can get over it pretty quickly, right?
Right.
If they're just yelling at each other.
Bob, forced or real?
I liked it fine. I think he has a good job of doing the dialogue and the interactions.
And
I didn't – let's put it this way. I read the issue and nothing in it leapt out at me as I was reading it as, you know, wow, that just doesn't seem right.
Okay.
You know, it flowed perfectly fine.
And same for you, John?
Yeah.
Because, again, there are some people out there who don't like Judd Winnick's stuff and, well, you know, I guess to each their own. But I've always been a fan of his ever since Exiles, really. Important question I have to ask everybody on the panel here. Do you want to do it in the kitchen? I don't quite understand his infatuation with the kitchen. I don't know, maybe that's...
He likes to make chili, so maybe he figured he can brew up a pot while he's doing the deed or something.
Well, that's just a disturbing image. Thank you, sir.
I live to serve.
Their decision to not do it until the wedding... And Green Arrow's, like, wine back there, it's like, well, it's a little late for white. I don't know. You could tell that these guys have been together forever. And by forever, I mean 40 years in continuity. Or 30 years, at least. And it certainly plays that way here.
And she does wear white, so...
Yes. Yes, she does. And you know what? That's why, like, that's one of those traditions that's never really worked well for me. It's like, if you want to wear white, wear white. It doesn't matter, like, really what you did beforehand. Another question... Would you invite Snapper Carr to your wedding? Especially after the incidents in this.
Not if he snaps while reading stuff. Oh, snap!
I would hope he would, actually.
He's snapping there.
Because if he snaps, he teleports. Or at least he did at one point.
I don't think he does anyway. He's snapping his fingers there on the two-page spread of the thing a little ways back. He's got some wonky Vans tennis shoes on, too.
Snap!
Ooh, snap.
Well, how else does he get the name Snapper Carr? Yeah. And when everybody's reading the invite...
I love Plastic Man.
Yeah.
It's going to be such a car wreck. Awesome.
That's kind of how my reaction would have been if I would have gotten that in the mail. Either that or what Hal and Roy's reactions were. Oh my God, they're going to do it. I thought he was just kidding.
He doesn't say the same thing, both, don't they? What is up with Alan Scott just thinking kids?
He's like ages old now. All he thinks is like blah, 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 grandkids.
Well, he was in the Justice Society with the original Black Canary, which was her mom. Mm-hmm. She kind of grew up around the JSA in this continuity. To him, they are kids.
I took the kids to not be that they're going to have kids, but it's going to be, you know, that that's the kind of thing that kids do.
Oh, you mean like kids?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Ah, okay.
Now, Vixen's response, I don't think she's ever seemed trampier.
Yeah. Just a little.
That takes another one off the market, mostly. It's like way to perk up your image there.
Zatanna's got a little bit of a negative attitude going on there.
Yeah. Oh wait, so that is Z, right? Because I was actually confused.
It looks like her. She's got the untied bow tie. Yeah.
All right. That's Zatanna.
Yeah, because I was
She doesn't always have that bow tie tied. She got to untie it sometime.
Because of the hair, I was actually thinking it could have been Selina Kyle.
But I was thinking Lois Lane, but...
Huh.
Can't tell by the invite envelope, so...
Yeah, the invite envelope just says squiggle, squiggle.
Well, would they give one to Lois Lane? They'd give one to Superman, right?
Yeah. The reason I thought it was Zatanna is because she's wearing an untied bow tie. Yeah.
No, I think you're right, Bob. I just didn't think that to begin with.
Now,
who's this guy next to Roy, to the left?
Let's see.
Glasses.
I thought it was Eddie.
Eddie Byers.
Yeah.
Who is? Why is he got the big? Is he in Checkmate or something? What's that big?
Not that I know of.
Knight thing behind him.
That's clearly the Checkmate Knight. But I don't know. The whole thing seemed a little weird.
You know, I think he might have actually just gotten introduced in Checkmate. I could be wrong on that. I think he has. If not, then I have no idea why it's there.
He very well may have, and it might have been a very forgettable introduction. Yeah.
Is this the same character that was in the Connor Hawke miniseries?
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking.
That's what I was thinking.
I mean, it would make sense for him to get the invite, because he's known, you know, Ollie for so frickin' long now, but...
Yeah.
Yeah, if the listeners out there know whether or not he's in Checkmate, please let us know, because I'm totally blanking on that right now. The conversation between... Wonder Woman and Superman on the next two pages. Again, I'm going to have to ask this question. This is something I'm going to be asking a lot for this. In character or out of character for Wonder Woman thinking that two superheroes shouldn't be getting together? John, you want to touch on that?
I don't know. It seemed more out of the blue than anything else. Whether it's in character or not, I don't know. It seemed a little out of character, not so much that her stand on it, that the fact she's kind of weighing in on that to begin with.
Because she doesn't have experience in that factor.
Well, it's more of it's a negative kind of a comment, and that part seemed a little out of character.
Well, I mean, she was raised by Amazon, so they've had this opinion for centuries that men weaken women, which is, you know, probably the reason why they set out by themselves. You know, they have this opinion, this rule of no men on the island. You know, because men are weak and stuff like that. So
yeah, but what she's saying here is that no, because she's saying she doesn't think two superheroes should marry each other. She's saying she thinks a superhero should marry a civilian to have an oasis of peace, like Clark married Lois, and that seems exactly 180 degrees different from the opinion she should have, Brent, based on what you just said.
Okay.
I could see – it seems like she should be behind it saying you should be marrying someone else just as strong as you so you don't have to worry about them.
Yeah.
And she's saying the exact opposite, which was weird.
Yeah.
Plus, I also think that if you wanted to, you could have taken Clark out of the equation here and replaced him with an 80-year-old grandmother and kept the dialogue the same, and everything he says here would have still worked. The whole, well, I think they're going to be great.
He was a little cheesy.
Yeah,
you're right. This could have been at the JSA Brownstone, and it could have been Ma Hunkel.
Right. That's what I was leaning towards. Yeah. Like, I was just going to mention Ma Hunkel, because it's like, I don't know, he's almost a bit too enthusiastic even for Smallville.
There is a golly gee whiz aspect to him there, yeah.
Yeah. It's like, for this issue, Superman has been replaced by Silver Age Superman.
Naive Silver Age Superman at that.
Yeah. While you know, Deathstroke and Dr. Savannah here, I never really imagined Deathstroke being so chummy with Dr. Savannah. The whole, like, throwing his arms up in the air, okay, I'm in.
There is a, almost will say, lackadaisical attitude of, yeah, sure, whatever.
Yeah.
Well, he seemed very much out of character.
He doesn't have much to do now that he gave his kids a family over in Titans. His fatherhood responsibilities have been stripped, you know. He feels like he can do whatever he wants. Yeah, he would be a little more laid back, wouldn't you, if you got rid of your kids?
Eh, my weekend's free. I guess I'll mess with the peoples.
That's the only way I can really think of it.
I mean, yeah. I like the way Dr. Savannah sounds in this. But Deathstroke, in his last couple of appearances, this was not the Deathstroke I grew to know.
Well, it's kind of counter... you know, Deathstroke was in, like, the last couple of issues of the old Green Arrow series, and he was a lot more serious than he is here.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
They're both written by Judd Winnick, so this does ring a little false if you compare it to, like, the previous issues.
Well, I guess this is that's, Judd Winnick on his happy point. Pills, maybe? I don't know.
Deathstroke's a Skrull.
I was waiting for at least one person on this call to mention that somebody was a Skrull, so thank you, John.
You're welcome. I live to serve.
And we get to the stripper scene Bob brought up before, and this stripper scene makes a hell of a lot more sense.
Wait, you didn't want strippers? Yeah, let's go this way.
Yeah, it's like, hey, you go down to the cars. I'm going to go tell the strippers not to come. Wait, did you say strippers? No. I said snapper car. He's not invited.
And Plastic Man's in his red and yellow suit, like, meh.
Train wreck, sweet. Oh, and also going back yet again to the Snapper Carr comment, yet another reason why you should never invite Snapper Carr to your frickin' wedding, because it ends up in the hands of the villains. How did it even happen? Did he snap and, like, end up in their domain or something?
I wouldn't think he has great security on his place.
Because he's Snapper Carr?
Yeah.
The heartfelt speech about, Dinah wishes her mom was here, that was probably the one that I think felt the most in character for Dinah, because obviously she's going to miss her mother in a moment like this. Felt very true. Going farther down, I guess let's just skip to the actual wedding. Isn't that a beautiful spread with everybody standing there waiting for Dinah to walk down the aisle?
Mm-hmm.
It's every character on here just has their own, like, unique personality that you don't find in many artists these days. You know, that they're able to make everybody look distinctly different and have a different look on their face in reaction to something.
Yeah, compare this page to the that Ed Bennis Justice League number one, those two covers, whereas everybody here looks different, and that one they all look the same, right, except for costumes.
Who are the two different guys in the top hats? You got the one on the left page in between Grace and Firebird. And then
that I thought
guy.
Was Zatar or whatever the title.
Yeah, Zatara. So who's the one above Barda over on the right-hand edge?
The limo driver?
I don't know.
Bruce Wayne in a clever disguise?
Nah.
No.
Yeah, because Bruce Wayne would be here for this.
I don't know. Well, for that matter, there are two other people in tuxes that don't look very familiar to me.
One of them is the assistant mayor or whatever of Star City.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
And the bodyguard?
And the bodyguard, I think, yeah.
Okay.
I was having a hard time placing the guy behind Animal Man.
Yeah, the guy next to Tempest?
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know either.
Alfred?
No, it's not Alfred.
Or who's the guy with the earring and the red shirt behind Snapper Carr? Keanu Reeves again?
Yes. No, actually, I think that is the same character. We just don't know who the hell it is. Like, now he's wearing a red tie. I really want to know who this person is.
Who's the short dude in front of Starfire?
Oberon.
That's Oberon.
Yeah, that's definitely
in
Oberon.
Stereo. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oberon. Yeah, so we get to the whole, you know, walking down the aisle that the, you know, the missiles launch and the villains come on in. So for the second time in as many events, the event gets ruined by villains. Very smart of them, though, to get the major players tracking missiles so they wouldn't actually be in the room to mess things up. There's certainly a better way to hope that you're going to be able to get things right with your invasion by getting rid of, like, Wonder Woman and Superman and so on.
There, they get out of the equation, like you said, the Kryptonian, the Amazon, and four Green Lanterns. Why do we have no Flash accounted? We got two Flashes, each of which should be able to take care of quite a bit of these guys.
Well, you go a few pages up, we got Black Canary kind of on Killer Croc. When did Killer Croc become 25 feet tall? Because if you look at the size of Black Canary in relationship to him, it's like he suddenly T-Rex sized or something. I don't know what the deal is with that.
Steroids. They just indicted Barry Bonds today, so steroids is on my brain.
Oh, you know what? That ape, I'll bet it wasn't Grodd. Maybe it was Mansoor Mala, and he just didn't have his beret on or something.
That could be.
That other one.
If we'd seen the brain, I'd be willing to go
with
that.
Well, Mala's on this page here.
He's holding brain.
Yeah.
He's holding the brain under his arm, and he's hitting Red Arrow.
Hey, I know that it's a Mr. Terrific villain, but who's the guy in the foul play jacket?
Mr. Terrible.
Mr. Terrible.
Okay. If you look at after the Mansoor Mala is hitting Red Arrow, the next panel has Mammoth.
Yeah.
And did he just grow a full beard and stuff since we saw him in the previous issue? Wow.
That's actually one of his... that's one of his major abilities that he never really talks about. He has to shave at least four times a day.
Not talking about it.
The Flash is dealing with Magma Man up there in the corner.
Yeah.
And Booster's there.
Animal Man's tackling Mala, and Mala's dropping the brain, and you see the little surprise lines coming off of the brain. Hey, I'm getting tossed.
Yeah. I'm actually kind of surprised that Booster's there. Yeah, you're right about
that. He's in the two-page spread.
Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, I would think he would be off in time somewhere at this point.
He's like, I'm not supposed to be here.
I wasn't even supposed to go into work today.
That'll be Booster Gold number 9, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I must say, I love the look on Speedy's face as she's firing those arrows. It's like she's got such a, like, oh, God damn it. It's like this is the first major wedding I've ever been allowed to go to, and you're freaking ruining it. When Batman comes on in, yet again, Batman's saving the day, because who do you count on in situations like this? The guy with no powers.
Mm-hmm.
Here's the important question to ask, okay? When do you think Green Arrow went missing? Going later on to the end of the book, when
after
do you think he went missing? After the cake?
After they ate cake. He probably had a stomachache, had to go to the bathroom, then the Amazons nabbed him. It's not real clear here.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it would have to be after this fight, because there's no way... I mean, we're ruining these things, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's no way every man is shooting arrows and crap like Green Arrow.
Right.
Especially this shot that he makes here on, you know, this page.
He doesn't have muscle memory to go along with his, like, transformation abilities, last I checked.
Yeah, I don't think he can do what, you know, he can look like somebody, but he can't do all the stuff that they can do. If he could, he would have probably overpowered Dinah.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I could kind of tell the change in Green Arrow even before I looked at the next page with the knife, because even, like, his dialogue seems to change a little bit from, like, I could never really imagine Green Arrow saying something like, oh, absolutely, but right now, the real fun of the evening is ahead of us. I'm sure he's probably trying his best to sound playful there, but it sounds way more menacing than it ever should.
I think every man really blew it here.
Yeah.
Because he should have pulled the knife out after. You know, it's like...
Maybe he's a necro. Who knows?
Yeah, I know. It's like, come on.
Was this as good as me? Was this as good for you as it was for me? Yep, in fact, so good, you're dead.
Why didn't she use her canary cry?
He's on her throat, man. That hand is right below her jaw in that one page as he's thrown her to the
ground. How about the one where she's got both her hands holding both of his hands with the knife and stuff?
Yeah, she could have canary cried him right there.
Yeah. I think at that point, though, she's thinking, I don't want to hurt Ollie.
That was right when she grabs the arrow?
Yeah, she's holding the arrow to stab through his neck at that instant.
I mean, yeah, but she's
Will that necessarily kill you, an arrow through the neck? I guess she went through the spinal column there.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely.
It's a broadhead arrow, a razor-tip broadheaded arrow. It's not just poking through. I mean, it's going to be slicing all kinds of arteries and stuff on its way through the
okay.
the neck there. I mean, that those things are nasty business.
Yeah. And
those kind of arrows.
In those last three panels that Amanda Connor draws, I think are probably the best panels she drew the entire book. Just the emotion that she puts into every single one of those panels on that last page. I was just, like, heartbroken.
Well, it actually makes you believe that she killed Ollie rather than Everyman.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Well, that was it. When I read this, I'm like, okay, what happened? And I'm like, I knew just because, you know, I've been reading comics so long that that's not Ollie, right? It's yeah. like,
nope,
they're not
going to
kill
gone.
Him. Although they did do a really good job, I think, in when you saw Green Arrow and Black Canary solicited, you know, and you've seen that cover for months, and you've seen that it was Connor and Dinah on mm-hmm. the cover, and that's the Green Arrow.
Yeah.
And you're like, okay, well, why isn't Ollie there? I mean, this is happening after the wedding. And the whole time I'm thinking, you know, leading up to this is like, what's going to happen? Why is Ollie not with Dinah? Is he going to decide to quit after the wedding and go back to just being the mayor? Or, you know, what's going to go on? And then they surprise you with what happens. But they did a nice job of that, I thought.
Yeah,
well,
no,
and they,
it's a great
they were very effective in not giving away the ending.
Yes.
I mean, we get to this point, and this was very credible because we had no clue what was coming next with Ollie.
Yeah, and plus, I mean, you're also thinking, like, hey, maybe this is just going to be, again, like what Bob just said. I mean, maybe Ollie's just off somewhere else this issue or doing something else. Like, maybe he decides, like, when I saw the solicitation for the first time, I thought, oh, maybe part of the deal is that he says only one of us should be a superhero, and I think you're much better at it. And he just decides to be, like, the family man. Back when these solicitations came out, this was before I actually read the last issue of the Black Canary miniseries. So I thought mm-hmm. that her adopted daughter was still going to be around. And that's why I thought one of them was just going to decide not to be a superhero anymore.
Yeah.
On Thursday, November 10th, 2005, it began. GeekSpeak at SpeakGeekSpeak.com. My first podcast. And, well, even if it was rough around the edges, it still got the job done. It gave me the itch. It made me want to podcast more. Then eventually, GeekSpeak got a little less regular. As I started Comic Timing, I lost a little bit of interest. Then I tried to restart it as the GeekSpeak Report. I got two episodes out of that, but still, it just didn't feel right. It felt like I was missing something. And then I figured out what. The fun I have with Comic Timing comes from the fact that I have people on with me, that I have a co-host like Brent, that I have guests on, that make it all the more fun. Well, I think it's about damn time to bring GeekSpeak back. The GeekSpeak Report will be returning in the new year, January 2008, and it will begin with a bang. The GeekSpeak Co-Host Challenge. 5 different people will be competing to see who will become the next co-host of GeekSpeak. The Marvelous Patrick, the Geekcaster, Wayne Cordova, Troy Mata, number 6, Tamalo, and the Yanni. All will be competing to see who will become the next co-host of GeekSpeak. Everybody will have a chance to vote on who is their favorite, and the winner will become the once monthly, possibly twice monthly, co-host of GeekSpeak. That, along with possible new segments, including which, a board game segment brought to you by T-Star himself. It's a brand new adventure here on GeekSpeak. Hope you guys enjoy it. And as always, have a great week. Enjoy your geek. The GeekSpeak Report. SpeakGeekSpeak.com. Check it out and enjoy.
Anyway, moving on. The team behind Green Arrow, Black Canary, number one. Yet again, Judd Winnick on the writing. But then you have Ed McGuinness, oops, I mean Cliff Chang, on arts and covers.
Hey, hey, hey.
Oh, dude, no, I'm not putting Cliff Chang down or anything. It's just his style is very, very reminiscent to Ed McGuinness.
What are you smoking? It is not.
I see more Matt Wagner-y kind of look to it.
I see more Matt Wagner, and it kind of draws a line to who did the last couple issues on Green Arrow, that last guy.
McDaniel?
Yeah, Scott McDaniel, kind of the looser style. And then that line ran into Amanda Connor, more animated style, and then to Cliff Chang, kind of draws a line of the same artistic vein, you know? Mm-hmm. You don't want to have McDaniel and then like Ed Benes or Jim Lee draw the wedding special and then go to Cliff Chang.
I see a lot of Steve Rude in some of the faces, too. Mm-hmm.
I think it's because the one face I'm looking at right now is the one on the actual like title page with the artist and writer and all that, and Black Canary's face there just screams Ed McGuinness to me.
All right, well, that face, but the rest of the issue does not.
Okay.
Yeah.
You don't have the over-muscled heroes in any of these pages at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's actually interesting because page to page, the style does kind of jump around. Like, if you look at the page where Connor's kind of up on the top of whatever that, a truck or something. You know, I look at the face there, and that's kind of got a Steve Rude look when he is doing the moth, mm-hmm. almost. And then you go a few more pages up, you get that, you know, that page with all the faces, the inset faces. That's another one. The way he draws Superman and Wonder Woman, that looks a lot like I've seen Steve Rude. But then flipping another few pages forward, the one where Batman's kind of on that cornice, mm-hmm. that's almost a very Matt Wagner-y kind of look from one of his covers. But it's like the style hops around a lot.
Yeah.
It's not terribly consistent from page to page.
I thought it was consistent. To me, like, everything flowed. I mean, I really like Cliff Chang. I loved his work on that Spectre Aftermath miniseries before that 8-issue thing launched, and I was glad to see him here. I mean, I think it's pretty consistent.
Well,
maybe the coloring helps that too.
I think it was good, but you know, it's like, okay, as a for instance, if you look at Black Canary's face on this 2-page spread on the, you know, where the title, it's about the third page in, right? And then flip 2 pages on and look at Black Canary's face in that horizontal panel. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Right, and then even on that very same page, to her face in the lower right-hand panel there.
Yeah,
it's just, it's not that he's bad. It's just that, and then you know, you go to the page with the staples, and you look at Black Canary's face there where she's next to Green Lantern.
Yeah,
it's not spot on to the same model, you know.
You look at those 2 pages.
And there's flavors of different artists in here. It seems like he's still trying to find his own style.
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
And I like a lot of what he's doing and a lot of the different ones. It's just that there's subtle differences in the way he's drawing from page to page.
Yeah.
Well, I've never seen a Steve Rude anything. So to me, this is, you know, Cliff Chang. I kind of understood what you're saying about the Matt Wagner Batman, but anywhere else, I really don't see like the Matt Wagner anywhere. Just in maybe that one Batman page.
No,
because Matt Wagner tends to draw like, you know, Batman is, he's, you know, all his muscles are covered by cloth, so you can't really see him. Which is kind of the approach he took in a lot of these pages for the heroes, except for Hal, I guess. I don't know. I do think it's consistent. It's like a animated, like, Rick. I see more Rick Burchett than Matt Wagner anywhere here.
Well, it's only that one place, really. There's a couple of places it looks Matt Wagner-y, but a lot of places it looks Steve Rude-like, especially in the faces. But then in other places it looks completely different. And I'm just saying there's enough difference in it that, you know, if I look at an artist that's got a very – well, I'm trying to think of a good word, but, you know, a very mature style where, you know, they've got their own style. Like, you look at Phil Hester's art, to take an extreme example, mm-hmm. right? it looks like Phil Hester in every single page, and there's a consistency to it
right
throughout. Yeah. And it just seems, and it's not like it's bad. I like his art. It's just that there's subtle variations from page to page. It seems like he's still finding his style. Well, and he'll get there, and then you know you're going to get like a really solid, consistent style out of this guy at some point.
There's even some panels in this where I see a bit of a Darwin Cook style in some of the Batman he draws. And even like in the first two pages here where we have the flashback with Green Arrow and Black Canary, even in that a little bit. But when you compare the Black Canary in those first two pages, I know it's a younger Black Canary, but when you compare the Black Canary in the first two pages to the Black Canary in the rest of the book, it looks entirely different. So there are major style differences all throughout this book. It's good art. It's great art still. It's just he needs to be consistent on something. On some level, he still needs to find that.
I agree there are art differences and certain style changes, but I'm not sure I would agree with major changes. I think they are fairly subtle unless you're really looking for them. In other words, if you're just kind of reading through the story and stuff, mm-hmm. it's not something that just hops out saying, oh my God, he went from like Gil Kane to Jim Lee to Sergio Aragonés or something.
That's
you know,
true.
Most of the styles we're talking about are reasonably similar. They're in the same school of art to a certain degree.
Yeah. And I'll compliment the colorist on something. She remembered to make Connor ethnic. Because I've seen a bunch of colorists forget that he is supposed to have an ethnic background. And just draw him straight white.
He's like half Asian or something, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's why he has that look to his skin. And it's so often I just see people entirely forget that when they color books that he's in. So again, nice touch on that all throughout this book here. Just going to the actual story, we got a very jaded Black Canary here, one that's like to the point where she's willing to almost like kill the villains that are showing up in this. This is somebody I would not want to cross, especially after the stuff that's happened to her in the last couple of months. Because this is, what, 2 months after the last issue?
It's about a month and a half. I don't think it was two.
In the conversation, like, I mean, Connor and Mia are, like, almost, like, scared for her that she's going to make a mistake and do something that she's going to regret for the rest of her life. She's so damn angry at this point. Do you see her reacting this way? Of course she would, but to the extent that she did to Ollie's death like this, Bob, do you see her reacting this way?
I see her reacting not to Ollie's death because she's convinced that it's not Ollie.
Okay.
You know, it's that she wants to figure out what went down and where is Ollie and what really did happen to Ollie, because she, throughout this, is absolutely convinced that that was not Ollie.
And she's the only one at this point.
Right.
Yeah, I think her driving motivation at this point is frustration. Frustration that, I mean, she knows that it's not Ollie, but nobody is, you know, helping her find out what's really going on.
And later on in the issue, almost everybody who, like, was in the issue previously who had their invitations, you know, saying how they felt, is here giving their condolences, and except for one, and that's, of course, the Amazons, which I guess must have been the dead giveaway, like, from the start. I mean, I was right away thinking, like, what the hell are the Amazons doing there? You know, what stake do they have in Black Canary in the first place? And it's specifically that's Athena there, right? I mean, I don't really, like, I'm not familiar with the way that Athena looks from issue to issue because she literally looks different every time I see her. But that's specifically Athena and the Amazons there that were in Countdown, right?
Yeah.
Okay. All right, yeah. So then this is the Athena in disguise, I'm assuming?
This is old
Gigi. That's what I'm thinking.
Granny goodness.
All right. Okay. And very powerful panel there also with Dinah, like, hugging the coffin like that, or stasis pod, or whatever the hell that is, that the quote-unquote Ollie is in, just, like, exemplifying how utterly depressed she is. That, again, later on as well, that Hal won't even believe her. And Hal's the one that had to bring him back from the dead the last time.
That seemed a little weird to me. Because she's absolutely convinced that it's not Ollie. Mm-hmm. So why would she be hugging the coffin of a body that she doesn't think is Ollie?
Well, she's still recognizing that the fact that Ollie's missing or something, and it looks like Ollie, so it might be Ollie. So that's the only thing of Ollie she has left to connect to.
I find it hard to believe, though, that she would let a month go by thinking Ollie is still out there and presumably in danger or whatever, and not have, you know, found him, rescued him, whatever by then.
Right.
I mean, this really should have been her hounding the Justice League, the Justice Society, the Titans, the Outsiders, the Metal Men, anyone she can find, mm-hmm. you know, go find Ollie, and then saying, you know, he's dead, or whatever, you know, but having a month elapse, that doesn't work for me.
And that Batman comes to her now, after a month.
Yeah.
If he had been thinking this entire time that this isn't Ollie, well, why the hell doesn't he say it in the first place? Wouldn't that be the first thing you do to console your friend that thinks she just killed her husband on their wedding night? You know, on their, like, honeymoon night? Isn't that the first thing you do?
Well, it's not like, you know, Black Canary's been hanging out for 100-some-odd issues with somebody in the Batman family, you know, of characters that would have a direct line or maybe even have some detective abilities of her own.
That could find out pretty much any piece of information on the planet given a week's hard work.
Yeah.
Her internet.
Well, Batman says it's, you know, Batman says it's been a month and no one's come to finish you off if they were after you or anything, you know. And nobody really had a reason to kill Green Arrow. So maybe he's been biding his time, you know, analyzing it for a month or something.
But even if he was analyzing it for a month, I would still go to her, and say, I don't think this is him. Let's wait a month, though. Let's see what happens.
I think Batman's of the mind that he'd rather not give her the hope unless he actually really thought it wasn't Ollie. He's not one to give false hope, you know?
But she already has false hope. Even without
him. Well, from her own self. Batman's not going to help her, you know, get any more. Mm-hmm. Know what I mean?
Yeah.
Well, and presumably this whole scene with Green Lantern, Black Canary, and Batman is taking place in Star City, so Batman did go to her.
Right.
You know, if it had been, hey, it's been a week and nothing's happened, I'd have been a bit more okay with it, but I don't know. Yeah. Too much time elapsed, and it doesn't make sense.
I am happy to see that Connor didn't believe that it was Ollie also, because it makes sense that the son would at least support the stepmother in this situation. That, you know, okay, well, she believes that it wasn't him, then I'm obviously going to believe that it wasn't him too. It's like he's almost trusting her judgment in this, because, well, she knows what his eyes look like. You know, and those were in his eyes. She's dead set on that. And, you know, as somebody who's, you know, had people in his life, connections between, like, eye to eye are something that you feel in a relationship. And when you don't feel it, you certainly don't feel it. Is that a believable reason to think that it was somebody else to you?
Yeah, that works.
Okay. All right. Brent, same thing.
I'm trying to flip back and see where he says he doesn't think it's Ollie either.
Oh, well, no. They say that in the conversation between Hal and Dinah. No one believes me, no one but Connor.
Oh, well.
And Hal says, I think Connor believes that you believe. And she says, he tell you that? And he says, no.
Okay.
Yeah, so that's why.
I was looking for Connor to say something like that. Mm-hmm. But he didn't.
Yeah.
So it could be hearsay.
Right. Well, hearsay, I guess, is something that'll happen in this life, and it's when situations like that happen. What are you going to do?
Well, let's get to the best part of the book, Batman with a buzzsaw.
Well, we're almost there, but I still want to be able to say this. And we've had three books in a row now where we've had Batman moments like this, where I get to say something along the lines of, you know, Dinah's all like to Hal, like, bring him back, Hal. And Hal's like, I can't, not now. I'm not going to become powerless again. He doesn't say that, but that's what I'm thinking in my head, though, because last time he tried to bring people back, he kind of went a bit crazy. He's like, this doesn't lie. And then Batman's like, no, but it can be deceived. I don't know. Does Batman really talk like this, or is this just how Judd Winnick makes him speak? I'm not even sold on that myself right now. John, does he talk like this on a regular basis, Batman?
Since you know him personally.
Right. I mean, you're buddies with him. You hang out all the time.
His speech pattern varies drastically from, you know, writer to writer. Mm-hmm. I think part of it is just the pacing of the dialogue being split, you know, across two panels, you know, across a page turn or whatever, makes it seem a bit more dramatic.
Okay.
Whereas if it had just been simply in one word balloon of no, but it can be deceived, that would have read differently. I think it's more a pacing issue than, you know, is this something he would say or not.
Okay. Bob, is this your goddamn Batman? Or is this a Batman that you just, that feels like it's being written the wrong way?
This did not bother me.
Okay.
When Frank Miller wrote that Batman dialogue that you just referred to, that bothered me.
Okay.
That seemed out of character. This seemed fine. It didn't make me sit up and say, "Oh, Batman wouldn't say that."
I mean, one of the things here is he's basically being supportive of Black Canary here, saying kind of, "Yes, I believe you." At the same time, kind of chastising her for not having been the least bit careful over the last month and having potentially put herself in severe danger because of that. I mean, there's a certain judgmental aspect very much in character with him.
Yeah. And what I very much appreciate, and this is actually an art cue here, is that on the page where Black Canary gives him the surprise hug, he gets those little shock lines on the top of his head. It actually harkened me back to that exclamation point that gets on your head when you're playing Metal Gear Solid. When you knock on the wall and the dude just that little noise came up. I can imagine that noise sounding when Batman gets hugged with those little shock lines. That was good times. That was good stuff.
All right. I got the joke.
Okay, good. Thank you. I'm glad. All right. Brent, you want to talk about your favorite moment, the buzzsaw moment?
I just thought I thought the pacing here was really cool. I think I can handle it. Well, we're almost exactly going to cut him up into little pieces. Batman doesn't have to say anything. He's ready to get to work.
He's got that big apron on to keep the splash from getting on him.
Yeah, it's the hostile apron.
Yeah.
He borrowed that from Ash.
It's the kind of thing, if she said, "I'm okay with that," he'd have put the thing down and gotten out the chainsaw.
That's almost the chainsaw, that thing.
Yeah, that buzzsaw is
something
like
that looks
away.
A lot messier.
I don't think he ever uses it, but he was just checking to make sure it worked in case they needed to use it.
The next step is you get the axe, okay? And you're like, "I'm just going to hack him up into random pieces," all right? So you go wait by the car.
He would have done whatever it took to get her to wait by the car is what it comes down to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like, I'm going to have sex with his dead body. Go to the car. You know, just do whatever it takes to get... All right, maybe not that. Maybe not that. He's not into that. Let's just away from that.
But, you know, this would have been a... No, go ahead, John.
Go ahead. Right. I was going to say, this would have been a good scene for Robin to be in. Mm-hmm. Not really to do anything, but just to hang out with Black Canary. We've seen a number of other comics lately where Robin's been kind of relegated to babysitter. So this would have been an interesting place because, I mean, he lost his father recently, so he knows that kind of thing, you know, whatever. So it could have been cool. Mm-hmm. Missed opportunity.
Yeah. What were we going to say, Bob?
I'm just kind of going to the end of the book, the reveal, and it's like, and these Amazons are giving Ollie quite a lot of credit. They've got him stripped down to a loincloth. He's tied up. He's in a huge frickin' steel cage, mm-hmm. hanging up over the ground. Apparently they got that, you know, man cannot set foot on Paradise Island thing going back, right? And there's 20 or 30 Amazons standing around him with spears. This is a month later, right? So you're telling me that, these 30 Amazons, standing around this poor slob for an entire month? It's, worse than Superboy Prime with the Green Lanterns watching them or something. I mean,
I don't think they were there the whole month, Bob. I think they're there after the month because he's been such a pain. Yes. And if we don't get flashbacks of him having at least two or three nearly successful escape attempts.
Okay. I hadn't thought of that. So if they do that, then I'll be okay.
You know what, like, actually?
But I agree.
Sitting here, yeah. Sounds like, man, that's a lot of guards for this guy.
Well, you know what makes me agree with John, actually? The gashes on his chest. You would think that would have happened during escape attempts. You know, that
well, you figure there's a dozen or so on the upper level in that room, at least a dozen or so on the bottom level, a dozen or so outside the building. I mean, they got a lot of people on this.
He's a pristine human specimen. What can he say?
Well, and it's more that they're expecting people to come get him more than him escape. I mean, aside from when he's yelling at him or whatever and not shutting up, the spears are usually pointed away from him than towards him.
Yeah, and you know what? It's probably a bad idea to be pointing spears at him, especially inside the cage, because this is a guy who uses arrows for a living.
Yeah.
Don't you think he might be able to grab a spear and throw it really well?
Well, his hands are chained behind his back, but...
Yeah, but that's never stopped him before.
He's Green Arrow, damn it!
Well, what about
if
back to the...
only he with a green spear.
Like, don't.
That's it. I'm going back in
Why
time.
Why did I have to make a bow on that island?
I could have made a spear. But yeah, let's go back. Were we going to comment on, Brent?
I was going to say, what about back to the Everyman reveal? What did you guys think about that? I, for one, was just finally glad to see that this guy was dead and he could practically never be used again, because he got pretty tiring there after a while. Seems like
Why
after
do you
52
think he can't
ended.
Be used again?
He's well, dead, isn't he?
He's died a few times.
Batman chopped his ass up.
He's a shapeshifter.
They took out
his
brain.
His brain out.
They pulled something brain. Out that looked like his brain.
Oh, come on.
He's a shapeshifter who's originally given his powers through technology, then given more powers through magic. Now, I'm sure he'll become a mutant, evil clone twin of somebody in a minute. This guy cannot be stopped. I think we're going to find out he really is Clayface's, you know, kid or something.
Yeah, you think?
And I expect him to come back is what it comes down to. Do I want him to come back? Hell no. I was tired of him the first three times.
Yes, because we have a Clayface already.
Got three or four of them.
Right.
Five, I think.
Yeah.
We have a lot.
Yeah. But especially with, and again, this is a bit of a spoiler for Manhunter. After he was in Manhunter, I got tired of him. And then he just
kept that's on. What did it for me.
After he kept on showing up, I was like, geez, come on, enough already.
Okay, the last page of the reveal where it's like he's a shapeshifter or whatever,
mm-hmm.
This third panel, the top of the head's back on.
Oh.
I'm going to go with they put the brain back in.
Okay.
They can use him again.
Oh, crap. God damn it. No,
who's
what?
To say that they didn't take it back out?
He wasn't using it anyways.
Or who's
well,
to
they
say?
sewed the skull back on. It doesn't mean they slapped the brain back.
Yeah,
that's exactly what I was going to say, Bob. There you go.
They sewed it back together so he could be buried nicely.
Fine. They leave the brain. Spock's brain is missing. Fine. I'm okay with that. So, I stand by. He wasn't using it anyways.
Oh! Wait. Now I get to make the best reference that I could possibly make. All right. Here we go. Yeah, well, Spock's brain is missing, and now they're putting it inside a tower. Good night, everybody. All right.
That's why you keep me as co-host, non-co-host, co-host, because I laugh at your stupid
jokes.
You
laugh at my stupid jokes. Exactly. If you don't laugh at my corny, stupid jokes, man, I'd just be standing here by myself, and there'd be crickets chirping.
I'm a fan of corny, stupid jokes, so, you know.
Yeah. No, because you make them yourself, and that's why.
Exactly.
Yeah. But, yeah, I'm glad to see that Batman is, like, proficient at the whole, like, examining dead bodies thing. And I'm glad Dr. Midnight's there, because could you imagine if just Batman had done it with the saw and there was no Dr. Midnight to back him up?
Okay. Speaking of Dr. Midnight there.
Mm-hmm.
Again, right before the same last page where he's called Everyman or whatever.
Yeah.
We're looking at Batman. We're looking at Dr. Midnight. What's that big thing behind them? Huge, big, bright lights. Is that really going to help Dr. Midnight?
That's why he's got his goggles on. It helps Batman.
Yeah.
This is Batman's cave. He's not going to operate in the dark. Batman's the boss host.
But he is the knight.
You can actually, if you go back a few pages, to where it first says the Batcave, the infamous buzzsaw page, you see the giant array of hexagonal light panels hanging over that table. So
yeah,
no, they were set up certainly. I'm just saying,
is a nice touch, I guess. Is what I'm saying is that it's consistent from panel to panel. You know, the way he drew the setup, you know, he's actually got a good sense for where things should be in the background when he draws these other scenes, which is
And good. You said the art wasn't consistent.
I said the details are consistent. The facial characteristics are not consistent.
Yeah. Okay.
And this Black Canary on this page, on the Everyman reveal page, that almost looks kind of like an anime kind of face going on there.
Yeah, actually, especially with the eyes.
That looks like a face that I'd see in, like, Death Note manga or something.
Ooh, I just finished Death Note. That was so fun.
Doesn't it have that kind of a look about it, though?
Yeah, it does. No, I'm with you there.
It's an upshot, so I guess as opposed to drawing some really weird funky lines showing the nose bone thing, you can just draw those two little nostrils. Well, I think it's more of an artistic choice.
It's like more of the eyes. I don't know.
Had they placed the eyes a little bit closer together, they would have avoided that. That's just placement issues right there, I think. Because the anime eyes are created by having the eyes a certain length apart. These are definitely anime eyes because of that. If they were a little bit closer together, they'd look like they did in the rest of the book.
Well, it's too bad you can't see my anime eyes rolling in the back of my head right now. But, you know, whatever.
Wait, you have anime eyes to go with your regular eyes?
I have to go put them on.
That's awesome. Brent has like 7 sets of eyes that he switches back and forth with every single day just to mess with people.
That's cool.
Oh, boy.
You got some crying eyes and lion eyes. And
that's 2. And anime, that's 3.
Can we make your brown eyes blue?
No, we should make that a contest. If you can guess my other 4 pairs of eyes, you'll win some old poster that Ian has under his bed.
Okay. A poke in the eye with a sharp stick, perhaps, could be a prize.
There's spears, I tell you.
You get to poke me in the eye. Maybe that's the prize.
Why couldn't we just give him a brand new Skype like we did that other time? The winner, a brand new Skype. Yay! All right, yeah, so final thoughts on the issue, as I think we've pretty much gone through the entire issue at this point. The whole, you know, wait until my wife gets her hands on you, yeah, that's going to be one hell of a contest right there. You've got 3 angry members of the Green Arrow family going towards Paradise Island. I really hope they're bringing reinforcements.
I'd like to see them bring all their buddies from the Justice League and just have the Justice League throw down against, you know, it's like we had Amazon's attack.
Wonder Woman did it in her annual.
Heft up, you know, Washington, D.C. and stuff. You need to take it back and leave some scorched earth there on Themyscira.
Yeah.
What they need to do is have Black Canary, Speedy, Wonder Woman in an all-female thing, a small contingent coming saying, we want him, we're taking him back. And they're like, you know, you and one army. Then reveal the entire island surrounded by even Z-list or whatever male characters, with Dinah pointing out that all they've got to do is set one foot on the island.
Ooh.
What's the deal with males on the island?
It makes them wig out, I don't know.
Oh.
I don't know. Magical thing. I don't know if that's in post-crisis continuity, but back in pre-crisis continuity, the Amazons were theoretically immortal, you know, kind of like a gift from the gods kind of thing, but they were only immortal given that no man ever set foot on the island.
Mm-hmm.
And if someone did, it would break the magic. But
haven't they had males on the island before? Like when they had ambassadors and stuff like that?
Well, Superman was and Batman were on the island when they introduced Supergirl.
Yep.
To everybody.
Yeah. Yeah, in the Superman-Batman arc.
But you can't really tell because Michael Turner can't draw feet.
Oh,
Yeah, did you ever actually see their feet touching the ground?
Yes. I'm sorry. In order to get on the Iodine, you must take your feet off.
Well, Superman could have been hovering.
And I'll grant that with Superman. Batman, not so much.
Are you telling me he does not have, like, bat hover boots?
Not that we've seen.
Okay.
He could have had some bat stilt shoes or something. Technically.
Oh, bat stilts. Stiltman is a Marvel character, sorry.
And he's dead.
Oh.
Thank you, Punisher.
Yeah, well, what are you going to do? All right, final thoughts on the series. Do you see yourself picking it up in the future? What do you give it as a grade? Whatever you want to say about it in comparison to, I guess, what you thought it was going to be like. These three issues as a whole, did they make you want to pick up issue two of Green Arrow, Black Canary? And we'll start with you, Bob.
Yeah, you know, I'm in for most of the DC stuff. I'm in for this series also. I give it a solid B, maybe a little higher. I mean, the JLA one was certainly higher in my assessment because of the Dwayne McDuffie writing.
Yeah.
I liked all of them. All of them were good, solid issues, you know, little things here and there, but certainly in the realm of good enough for me to keep on getting.
Brent?
I'm in the same arena as Bob there. I liked all the issues. I will agree that the JLA one was the better issue, mainly because I guess a lot more happened in it. We got a whole bunch of different scenes, whereas the other ones you had were some more talky scenes, where that one is like balls to the wall action compared to the other two. But I will out of the wedding special and issue number one, I'll have to go with the wedding special over issue number one, just because it was so much fun seeing all the characters' reactions and all that.
Right.
So I'm in for the first couple issues of this series, if you know, the first arc or two, and after that we'll see.
You got a grade for it?
A B. I mean, I guess a B for all of them. Maybe an A for the JLA issue.
Mm-hmm. Okay, cool. I'm definitely in for the long haul on this because I was reading Winnick's Green Arrow. I've actually read Green Arrow, every issue of Green Arrow since Kevin Smith's number one. And I love the family dynamic of Green Arrow. And Black Canary just adds a brand new aspect on that. This three-issue arc, like I said, I was expecting a lot less from the JLA issue. I got a lot more that made me happy. The actual wedding issue, the surprise at the end, my jaw dropped the first time I read it. And the final issue, as I consider it, the first issue of Green Arrow, Black Canary, was a wonderful continuation of that series. The art has been great all the way through that, so I'm going to give it an A minus. It's not quite at the top yet, and if the art gets a little more consistent in Green Arrow, Black Canary, it's probably going to be one of the first books I read every single month. I just picked up issue two actually at the store this past week, as it just came out the week that we're recording this, and I expect to pick up three after that, and four, and five, and so on. John?
Well, as you know, I'm a highly discriminating buyer, so the question of if I want to continue getting these or not is one I ponder long and hard. Now, this Justice League of America title, which, of course, is a very new and unique idea, never tried before. I think it was seriously the best of the three. I thought it was a great launch to Dwayne McDuffie's run. I would give it an A rating, no question about it. Mm-hmm. For the character aspects, was it a good wedding special? No. Was it a good annual for Justice League or special issue of Justice League? Yes. I enjoyed that. I thought it was great. I would kind of put the Green Arrow Black Canary number one above the wedding special, Green Arrow Black Canary wedding special, that is. Because while Amanda Connor did some really good art and stuff, there were places it was almost too kind of cartoony or whatever. The style was just enough different, mm-hmm. particularly after Mike McCone's art, that it didn't really work as well for me as I would have liked.
Okay.
And there were a few things, particularly with the fight scene and when did, you know, the switch for Green Arrow take place, that even having read the Green Arrow, Black Canary number one, I still don't really see where the pieces fall together. And if they do a second Green Arrow Black Canary wedding special, obviously I'm going to get it, but obviously not going to happen. And I'm okay with that because I'd feel obligated to get it, and really, you know, once is enough for that kind of special. Certainly, I'm looking forward to the Green Arrow Black Canary series. I'm curious which Green Arrow we're going to have for the long haul in this. Because like Bob was saying, they could bring Ollie back, but have him as a supporting player and, you know, a key member of the book or whatever, just not the Green Arrow of the book. And really, putting him in almost an Alfred-type role for the characters could be a really interesting twist. But I was really pleased that the spins they did at the end of the issues, you know, looking like they killed off Ollie and now seeing Ollie back and stuff like that, were really fun, really good, and you know, this is some of the best I think the Green Arrow stuff's been for a while.
Yeah.
And I've been reading since the 4-issue miniseries way back when, which, I mean, I'm not sure, but that might have been the first time Green Arrow had his own title. So this is good stuff.
Cool. Yeah, and I mean, I've only been reading Green Arrow since the, you know, I guess the late 90s, or, yeah, I guess around that, because I did read some of the Connor stuff sporadically, and this is definitely the best it's been since the beginning of Winnick's run. Winnick's run got a bit tired there for a little bit, and I'm hoping it's going to continue to be good here with Green Arrow Black Canary. All right, before we go here, actually, I have a couple of comments and actually a email to read. This one actually is start with the email first from Andrew Pellerito, and I want to read this because it actually mentions John at some point. Just a quick note letting you know I discovered Comic Timing podcast about a month ago and wanted to thank everyone involved for entertaining me during my workday. We'll try and comment on a few things now that I'm about caught up on the shows. I really love the interaction between you all and reminds me of when my friends and I get together to talk games and comics. I do think sometimes you need someone who has read comics before the 90s, but maybe that's why I like John Mayo so much. He seems more my age, though I am excited to hear there are those raised on comics in the 90s that have a love for comics and the comic industry as I do. Keep up the good work, and looking forward to hearing number 50. Congrats, and that's from Andrew Pellerito. And that's what we try to do here on Comic Timing. We try to get different perspectives, and, well, that's why we like having Bob and John on so much. Yay!
That's why we like being on. But make sure you tell that guy about our podcast, you know, with the weekly comic spotlight and the back issue spotlight and the other spotlights and other episodes we do and stuff, because he might like those too.
Back up. You do a podcast?
Yeah, it's a small little thing. You know.
How do you not keep your house from burning down with all those hot, heavy, hot spotlights?
I podcast
on at one time in a week.
That's how I get rid of the heat.
And I just minor fluorescent bulbs, and they don't generate that much heat.
All right, here's some passing comments here from the actual thread that we did on this 22 pages, back when it was still 22 pages. Wraithmaker, Raph on the forums. Hi, Raph, how are you? He's a Geeks Uniter, and he's actually a proud member of the Comics Podcast Network now, so congratulations to him, and both John and Bob are members now as well with their various podcasts. At first, I was a little put off by the idea of a wedding special, but considering what I've heard from Jan Jones and what I've read in the build-up stuff to this Countdown Black Canary, I'm actually interested in what will happen now. And that's from Raph. Quick comment here from... Actually, real scrolling down here, again from Andrew with his forum name now of Black Scarf. He did an article on why do archers get all the hot chicks, which I'm going to actually link to in the show notes for this. It's over at fanzing.com. That's FANZING.com. And it's /MAG/fanzing39/feature4.shtml. And yet again, I'll put a link up there for it. And it specifically poses the question, why do archers get all the hot chicks? So that's kind of fun. And Vidara had a very heated response. Don't even get me started, guys. Don't even freaking get me started. I've had the impulsive urge to strangle Winnick ever since the proposal was announced. And that's Vidara. Yeah, that's the one negative comment we got in response to this. What are you going to do? I guess not everybody's going to like the proposal. Oh, well. I'm still mesmerized by her signature with the dancing Peter Parker. That is fun times. All right, I guess we're done here mostly, but before we go, obviously I want to plug everybody's stuff here, starting with John and Bob. What's upcoming on your multiple spotlights?
Let's see. We just released the first preview spotlight, where we cover the items from November 2007. We've got a number of people who submitted short things on items that they recommend. I thought that turned out pretty well.
Right. I'll add there, John, that we're going to be doing that monthly, and we encourage any of the listeners and other podcasters as well to contribute clips on a monthly basis for books that are particularly catching their eyes out of each month's previews catalog.
Yeah, we want that to have as many voices as possible and cover as wide a spectrum as comics of comics as possible, beyond just what Bob and I get. Because while we get a lot of stuff, there's a ton of comics we don't get. So we want to hear about those too. Maybe, you know, we'll buy a few more things ourselves. Upcoming on the back issue spotlight, we've got an episode we've recorded, but I still need to edit on the Englehart, Marshall Rogers era of Batman. We were joined on that with Brian Christman, Pants, over at Comic Geek Speak. And we also talked about buying back issues at conventions and stuff, which, of course, he's got a lot of experience in, as does Bob.
Cool.
And then we've got the weekly comic spotlight coming up with yet another week's comics spotlighted. The next one we're going to do is going to have All New Atom number 17, New Avengers Illuminati number 5, and PvP number 36. That should be up. So, you know, head over to the comicbookpage.com website, click on podcasts, and, you know, go check it out. We've got tons of episodes, and, you know, hopefully you'll find something you like listening to.
Excellent. Sweet. It's all good stuff, and I contributed to the first preview spotlight, and I will certainly continue to do so as the previews keep coming out, as it's a lot of fun to actually you know, like submit your things on what you are looking forward to in the actual previews catalog.
Cool. We appreciate the submission.
Yeah, great to do it. Brent, you got any upcoming for BK's Bullets?
The Smallville one that I did on the Smallville season premiere, which was ages ago now, is going to be on their Smallville episode, which is upcoming. I don't know when exactly. And then after that, I still have Superman Emperor Joker to record, so expect that.
Cool.
That's about it.
Cool.
Oh, and I'd like to throw out a shout out to Rick Gordon's Pop Cult Online podcast. John and I both guested on that this week. I don't know, he should have that out in the next week or so, but we talked about toys and toy collecting this time around.
I feel so bad because I forgot to show up to the one that I suggested.
The anime manga one?
Yeah, the anime manga one. Yeah, because it just entirely slipped my mind, and afterwards I'm like, no. But
we may be redoing that show, because Rick was telling us when we recorded this toy one that he seems to have lost that episode into the ether somewhere, find it.
It's bad for me to say good, but good. I'd actually like to be in on that one, so I'll get in touch with them and hopefully be able to get back on that.
In fact, I actually have some good news since this episode was recorded. I actually was a part of the Pop Cult Online episode 30 that was the anime discussion that Rick was able to redo. And on that call as well was Bob Breitall and John Mayo. So, kismet. How about that?
Did they release the one on podcasting yet, by the way?
Not yet, no.
Okay, cool.
Haven't seen it go up yet.
Okay, well, just make sure to check it out, though. It is actually a really good podcast. And are you anywhere else this month, Bob, or is that it?
I think that's it, and then, you know, obviously this show.
Oh, and Amazing Spider-Cast. You were on Amazing Spider-Cast.
Oh, I was. Actually, that's right. I was just on Amazing Spider-Cast. We were talking about the 70s Clone Saga.
Yeah. I actually
the first
listened to that
saga.
I listened to that over the last couple of days, and it was a lot of fun learning about that one. That's the one I didn't know that much about other than the What If. So you guys filled me in a lot. Okay, great. Upcoming here on Comic Timing, we've got an episode that's hopefully going to be recorded next week, the day before Thanksgiving, at least in the timeline, because it'll probably come out of a couple of weeks after that. But as of now, we're going to be joined by Chris Gallo, Webhead, and possibly Jen from Amazing Spider-Cast as we do the life and times of Spider-Man. So that should be a lot of fun. And probably go through most of his career there, from the beginning to where he is now with the One More Day and Brand New Day and all that crap. So it should be plenty of fun there. Once again, thank you guys for joining me here on the show. It was a lot of fun, and always great having John and Bob on here to join us. So I want to thank you guys for coming on.
Happy to do it.
Thanks for having us.
You're quite welcome, man. And anytime you want to come back, you know you're more than welcome. And as always, Brent, thanks for laughing at my jokes.
You're welcome.
The email address for Comic Timing is comictiming@gmail.com. Don't forget to check out the forums over at thecomicforums.com/forum. Graciously hosted by the Comic Geek Speak guys over at comicgeekspeak.com. We're proud members of the Comics Podcast Network over at comicspodcast.com. And we're also members of the League of Comic Book Podcasters over at comicbooknoise.com/league. Please vote for us on Podcast Alley. Please dig us on dig.com. And please send us your iTunes reviews. Especially, please send us your iTunes reviews, as they're really graciously appreciated and give us plenty of great press in the process. So, once again, for Bob and for John and for Brent, I'm Ian Levis, reminding everybody out there that there's always time for comics. Even when we say it's going to be 22 pages and it's about 60.
And that wraps up this syndicated episode of the Comic Book Page Podcast. My name is John Mayo, and I've been your host. If you have any questions or comments, my email address is podcast@comicbookpage.com. Thanks for listening.